like to convene the September 29th, 2015 meeting of the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good afternoon to everyone. Our agenda today, we're going to have a very brief organizational meeting. Any of you who've sat in on other committees, it's just a big ditto. After that, we're going to talk about the changing dynamics of Oregon agriculture, and I think most of the folks in this room know that that is one of the biggest economic sectors in our state's economy, and the fact that it is a growing and dynamic sector bodes well, I think, for our entire state. And then lastly, we're going to revisit once again fire season and the devastating fires that are occurring on many of our state and federal lands, private as well. But I just want everyone to keep in mind that there is a lot of destruction that is going on and a lot of the public's timber, the taxpayers' timber, is being burned up. And folks, we got to do something about this, and we got to find a better way to do it, because it is not in the cards to be getting any better if we continue down the road that we've been going down. It's getting warmer, it's getting drier, the fire season's getting longer, and there's a heck of a lot of timber that's being burned up. We got to do something different. We're going to be hearing from some people about that here today. And with that, I am going to open the organizational meeting. And I think most of our members are known by most of the folks that are regulars here. But I do see a few new faces in the audience today. So, Representative Barreto, hate to catch you off guard here, sir, but if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, briefly describing your district, and maybe what interest you have in ag and natural resources.
Sure. Greg Barreto. I'm from Cove, Oregon. That's about 15 miles east of LeGrand. It's in District 58, which is Wallowa County, Union County, and then part of Umatilla County. I have been over there for 30 years. We have a business in the area. Decided to run for the legislature a couple years ago, and I got elected. So agriculture's a big issue in our area. It's a big income generator. Natural resources, timber, used to be the mainstay there, but it's still important. We have Boise Cascade Mills in LeGrand, three of them, one in Elgin. And then most of the mills have shut down in Wallowa County, but it is still revenue driver over there. So that's the district I serve. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. I do not have one cow in my district, so therefore we don't have much agriculture. But our county and our area has a lot. We were basically a timber-based economics. Now that's gone by the wayside. Used to be you could get a job in four or five different plants. Today we don't have four or five plants. It's such a shame, because just to give you some kind of a what's happened in my area is I pulled green chain in 1970 for $3.74 an hour. You equate that out today, it's $22.68 an hour. Great paying jobs. Those are all gone. We went to a commercial, retail, service-based economy, which in turn, I look at this like a baseball team. You took a 400 hitter out of the lineup, you benched them, and you inserted a 150 hitter. Your average drops. That's what our economy has done and continues to go forward. We talk about jobs, but we talk about jobs that are $9, $10, $11 an hour. That doesn't help our economy. We're just fooling ourselves. My whole thought process has been, how do we get to utilize our two natural resources that are the only two natural resources that are renewable? That's water and that's timber. And thus far, we have done an inadequate job on either one. So I've been in the legislature 11, 12 years, something like that, and I was on the Medford City Council 7 years prior to that as well.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
I am from House District 29, which is Forest Grove, Cornelius, and also West Hillsboro. And I've been a school teacher out that way for about 42 years and then retired to run for the legislature. And I was raised in Oregon on farms in Marion and Clackamas County. And on our own farm, we raised broccoli, green beans, and about 150 head of dairy cattle. And then we moved to Clackamas and had a little bit more of a crop base there and no dairy cattle and dairy cows. And my area out my way, House District 29, we've got a lot of different crops. We've got hazelnuts, we've got vineyards, we've got nursery, we've got some strawberries, a few. Used to be a lot more strawberries out that way. We have a lot of different types of large acreage still. We have like grass seeds and different types of things like that. And so it's both an urban and a rural area, and so I care a great deal about urban and rural coexisting in a very profitable and cordial way. And so I love this committee.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Oh, thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair. I'm Catty McEwen. I represent House District 9. This is my second term in the Oregon Legislature. My district goes from the southern edge of Coos Bay to the northern edge of the city of Yahats. I represent four counties: Coos, Douglas, Lane, and a small part of Lincoln. And I'm very honored to be here. This committee is such an honor to be a part of. I represent, of course, communities that have long, rich agricultural history and history in the timber industry. We have dairy farmers. We have ag. We have a lot of fisheries issues, and these are all things I care deeply about. I was born and raised in Coos Bay. I go back about four generations. My husband goes back about five. So these are things that we've been involved with our entire lives. I think following on what Representative Esquivel had to say, my community has been in a recession for 30 years. I grew up in a town that was vibrant, and everybody had a job, and they were well-paying jobs, and we had 2,000 kids in our high school. At this day, we have under 800 kids in our high school. I was a school board member for 11 years or so, and I had the great, great misfortune of closing during my tenure. We had 10 elementary schools when I began. When I finished my service, we had two. And it's strictly a function of how we manage our natural resource-based economy on the South Coast. So I'm happy to always be part of these conversations and trying to find those solutions and those ways that we can in our very timber-strapped economies and resource-based economies that have changed dramatically in the last 30 years, finding solutions to how we can again become healthy using the assets that we have. So as Chair Witt knows, I'm delighted to be on this committee.
And we're delighted to have you, Representative McEwen.
And I was an ag major way back when.
Representative Whitsitt.
Yes, I'm Representative Gail Whitsitt. I represent House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake County. Klamath County and Lake County's major economic drivers were timber and cattle, and cattle are the largest agricultural commodity in the state of Oregon, even larger than nursery. Sorry, Jeff, but yeah. And I grew up on a large ranch in Montana. Our cattle camp was the place where the first wolves were reintroduced into the United States, the lower 48. I have a degree. I have 2 degrees in geology out of Oregon State University, so I'm very interested in the economics of mining and extractive resources in the state. And my husband and I have, he's a veterinarian, also a senator, we have a farm in Klamath. We raise horses, warm-blood horses right now. So I'm really happy to be on this committee and hopefully bring something to it regarding rocks, at least.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Lou Frederick. I'm a representative from District 43. It is the smallest district in the state. I can walk my district from north to south in about 45 minutes or an hour if I'm not stopped by someone on the street, and usually I am stopped by someone on the street. In Lloyd Center area of Portland, if you get a sense of where I am. I have a background that's a little different than most folks expect. I was a television reporter for 17 years. I was the science reporter. I have a minor in molecular biology. I have a major in theater and another minor in psychology and in political science. I managed by way of being a reporter to go to all 36 counties in the state and got a chance to spend time there. Truly enjoyed it. My district, actually I found out we have three cows in my district, just so that you know. At least three that I know of. We have a lot of chickens. A lot of chickens. The Portlandia stuff in terms of chickens is not exaggerated, let me assure you. I have three chicken coops on my block alone right now. I also got a chance as growing up. My father was the son of a sharecropper. He worked as a sharecropper as well. So I spent time with my relatives in Mississippi and southeastern Missouri. Picked grapes, not grapes, but cherries in Michigan, just because not for my own sustenance, but for other folks, and then I was a ranch hand in Nebraska, on a ranch in Nebraska for several summers, and so I have at least a sense of the kind of work that's done. And the knowledge that I don't want to be doing that work, so that's another story. Quite frankly, I'm impressed and respectful of all the folks who do get out there and do that kind of work in the fields and feed the rest of us and feed what's going on and make sure that we have an economy that is moving along. We use and eat and process much of the material that comes out of the state of Oregon. And we help to export it because all three sides of my district have railroad lines on them. I-5 goes through my district. We're just a little bit away from the airport, and the river, the Willamette River, is also one edge of my district as well. So I feel a connection with the rest of the state, and I'm really pleased to be on this committee.
Thank you so much. Vice Chair Krieger.
Well, I've been here too long. 8 terms. I think there's 3 of us in the legislature and the House have been here 8 terms. And in my prior life, I wore a blue uniform. You can figure out what that might have been. Had a logging company for 10 years and felled timber after I did that. So I didn't start falling timber until I was 51 years old, which is a little bit late to start. But I can remember I went from 197 to 183 pounds the first summer. So it's hard work, and I don't do it anymore. This morning they took the 47th load of logs off our tree farm. We have a tree farm down in Curry County. And when I got to Curry County in 1964, there were 11 mills, and today there's 1. So the whole economy and the culture of people and their ability to earn a living and our young people to stay in the community and find a job is greatly depressed from what it was. And we need to continue to work to give opportunity in our rural settings for young people. And right now that's extremely difficult. We have, as I said, timber and grow a few head of cattle to keep the grass down, the fire danger down. And know, Coos County has about 70% of my district, Curry, all of it, and a little bit in Josephine and Douglas. Everybody's been mentioning their, you know, you were, what's your district, 50?
43.
43, and you're?
56.
And mine's District 1, and you get that because you're rated.
Rated what?
Wow.
Now, what, the number one in what, Representative?
Well, I'm Brad Witt, and in addition to being the chair of this committee, my district used to be one, and before it was stolen from us, but that's another story. I grew up in an extremely rural New England, and hunted and fished at every opportunity. Put myself through college working in a sawmill in Massachusetts, actually several. People are sometimes astounded by that and didn't even know that trees grew there, let alone that we had a sawmill industry. I moved to Oregon during the very bad recession of the 70s when you couldn't even buy a job. And so got to compare sawmills east and west coasts. And I can assure each and every one of you that they're vastly better here on the West Coast. Lost my job in that industry back in the 80s when they shut down the federal forests. And so I understand what individuals as well as communities have been through when there is great economic decline in many of our state's traditional industries, fishing, farming, and forestry. It has been my desire as chair to try and find a means by which we can arrive at the truly, and I mean this, truly sustainable management of our state's natural resources. And folks, we are blessed with an abundance of this. But that sustainability to me means a three-legged stool with a bucket of milk on it. And if we shore any one of those legs, be it economic, social, or environmental, we tip over our bucket of milk. And so I am the luckiest chair of anyone in this building to have these fine people here on this committee. And those of you who have an interest in ag and natural resources, any interest at all, be it economic, social, or environmental, I think should feel very comfortable in and before this committee. And with that, welcome to everyone. Thank you. We have some great folks that are going to be here this afternoon. I understand, Adam, that we have some rules to adopt here. And committee members, hopefully you have had an opportunity to review those. Any questions or discussions on these rules? Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2015.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2015. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, if there is no objection, and I am seeing none, the motion passes. Thank you all very, very much. I'm going to close the organizational meeting, and I'm going to open an informational meeting, first of all, on the changing dynamics of Oregon agriculture. And let's see, we have, first of all, please, I'd like to call forward Director Katie Kova. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon.
Members, I'm Katie Kova, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. It's great to be with you this afternoon talking about one of my favorite subjects, agriculture. And you have a couple of things that are being passed out to you. The first is the State of Oregon Agriculture Report, which is a biennial report that our Board of Agriculture kind of works with us on developing, and we handed it to each and every one of you last year, but it was early in the session. You get a lot of material, and so some of you may not have had a chance to look at it. It really is a great document, especially to just give you a high-level kind of overview of what's happening in Oregon agriculture today and the changing dynamics. You've got a great panel that's following me that will go into more detail in some of the sectors of the industry, and I hope to just kind of tickle your imagination, if you will, in preparation for that panel. In the report, I would ask that you pull out, there's a standalone document, it's called the Summary of Oregon Agriculture Industry Report, and it really is a quick synopsis of the more detailed information that is available in the report. And the other thing that we did for this report for the first time ever is we had an overview of kind of issues statewide for Oregon agriculture, but then we also did a breakdown of regions around the state. And so I think all of you, because as you have rightly identified, have agriculture in your district, as does I think everyone in this body, you may be interested in kind of getting a sense of what's going on in your region specifically. I think, and I do this often, but it's always fun for me to say that agriculture in this state is doing so well. And there are always years where certain sectors have great years and other sectors maybe don't have such great years. You will hear a little bit about that today. But overall, the diversity of Oregon agriculture really contributes to a fabric and a strength of our industry that is pretty steady from an economic perspective year in and year out. When you take production agriculture, when you add processing and transportation and marketing and all the components that go from getting a product from the farm to your fork, agriculture represents about 15% of Oregon's economy. We are the second largest traded sector behind high technology. Most of what we produce in the state leaves our state's borders. So, Representative Frederick, as you talked about truck and rail and air and freight, we need those things to get Oregon agriculture to its end point. 80% of what we produce in the state leaves our state's borders, and half of that moves into an international market. So you will see the first three items in your summary really deal with that market access. And you mentioned, Mr. Chair, your three-legged stool.
Yes.
I often refer to a three-legged stool as well for Oregon agricultural products and where they end up. That local and regional market would be one leg, the yes. domestic market would be the second, and the international market would be the third. And we try to pay attention to all of those markets. And there's exciting things going on in every single one of them. The fourth item on page one, transportation, I think we can't talk about enough, and I will touch on it a little bit more a little later. And then on the second page, an issue that I would really highlight in terms of the changing dynamics of agriculture, and that's the challenge of entry into farming and agriculture in this state. We in Oregon have a higher than national average in terms of age of the farmer in the state. We have a lot that we know are going to be retiring in the next 5 years. And so who's coming in their shoes? Some of those are in the family. Not all of them are. And I think figuring out ways to bring new, young, and beginning farmers into this industry is going to be very important. It's difficult. Access to capital is a huge issue. The Farm Bill in 2014 did provide some additional resources to young and beginning farmers and ranchers, and we're hopeful that that does help dealing with some of these issues. And you at the state level have also provided some resources. But I think this is an area that we need to continue to pay attention to. Labor has been an issue in our industry for a long time. The debates around immigration reform are huge for us. We struggle to get labor in the summer months during harvest, and we're not seeing that issue go away by any means. Food safety is another topic that will fall into that changing dynamic of agriculture, and I'll speak to that a little bit more in a minute. And then finally, last but certainly not least, water, both in terms of water quantity and water quality are huge issues for agriculture in this state. We in the Department of Agriculture have spent countless hours on our ag water quality program. Some of you have heard reports from us in terms of where we're taking that program and trying to be more strategic and be able to demonstrate results. We're extremely committed to the work in that area. And then the water quantity issue. I'd like to thank all of you for your support for the additional investment into the Water Resources Department to the tune of about $50 million in bond capacity to do more work in water quantity issues. We know with changing climate and the fact that we seem to see a shrinking snowpack, and that is the largest storage of water in the state, that we've got to think creatively about where our future storage for water is going to come from. And the reality is that for out-of-stream uses, agriculture is the largest user of out-of-stream water. And when we apply water to land, great things happen. So we need to continue to have access in order to do that. The second little smaller document that you have in front of you is Oregon Agriculture Facts and Figures. We publish this document every year, and these are the results of 2014 agricultural year. If you open it up, I do want to highlight the middle section, Oregon's top 20 commodities. And this is where two of my friends behind me, I don't want to start another fight, but we did see, when you think about changing dynamics, but really not a huge change, that cattle and calves last year overtook nursery and greenhouse in the state in terms of the top value for production in Oregon. It's been flipped. Nursery and greenhouse has been number one for 15 or more years, with cattle and calves number two. So I know the folks in our beef industry are pretty proud of that fact, and they're not shy about telling you about it. But the reality is the top 20 products that you see on this list are usually somewhere on the list any given year. What really changes, more so than volume of production in most sectors, is the price for that year. And we have seen wonderful prices for beef in throughout the United States. A lot of that is driven by extreme drought in the Midwest over the last 5 years, and a record low supply in terms of beef in the United States, and that's driven prices up. And our cattle sector here in the state of Oregon has benefited from that. I think the other two that I would point out, or three that I would point out on the list, and some of the trends that we're seeing in terms of expansion in production in Oregon, first would be blueberries. Blueberries is very much a hot commodity these days. A lot of that is driven by an Asian market that puts a lot of emphasis on healthy and nutritious foods, and blueberries rank right up there. Some of you have heard me tell this story, and if you have, I apologize, but many years ago I was on a trade mission in Japan, and we were in a grocery store, and Oregon blueberries were on display, and a picture of the farmer for those blueberries was also there, and this farmer wore glasses. And for the picture in the display, they made him take off his glasses because blueberries have a high antioxidant, and that's supposed to help your eyesight.
No.
And so they didn't want the picture of him with his glasses on. But these kinds of trends really do impact both what we see in terms of production as well as price for product. And Oregon was the first and only state working a very strong coalition with the federal government, our blueberry industry, and the Oregon Department of Agriculture to open up South Korea to fresh blueberries. We're still the only state that is allowed to export fresh blueberries to South Korea, much to the chagrin of some of our other neighbors that grow blueberries. The second product that I would highlight for you is hazelnuts. We're also seeing a growing demand for hazelnuts and hazelnut production in Oregon. We are the number one producing state of hazelnuts in the United States, and you can see that list on the far right-hand side. We're number one in a number of product areas, but we continue to see growing demand for hazelnuts, which are grown primarily here in the Willamette Valley. And then finally, for my friends in the grape and wine industry, grapes broke the top 10 mark this year for the first time ever, listed at in 10th place, and we know that the demand for Oregon grapes and for Oregon wine just continues to grow and grow and grow, and this continues to be a very prosperous and prominent part of agriculture, not only in the Willamette Valley, but in southern Oregon and along the Columbia River corridor. So those are just some highlights in terms of what we're seeing in some changes in demand for Oregon agricultural products. I want to shift to highlight just a few other areas in terms of some opportunities and some challenges for the industry. First of all, as you noted in our overview, I mentioned food safety. And we in the Department of Agriculture work very closely. We inspect all food processors in the state for food safety, as well as all grocery stores. And in 2010, the federal government passed the Food Safety Modernization Act, which folks in the Food and Drug Administration would say is probably the largest and most sweeping new act that they have ever tried to implement. We are just now seeing federal rules around implementing this act be finalized, and we are going to have fresh produce growers here in the state of Oregon that will be regulated under the new FSMA program for the first time ever. This is going to be implemented, phased in over about the next 5 years, and it is a huge change for our industry and for many of these growers. Despite the efforts to get the word out that this is coming, I would say the majority of them don't know that they are soon to be regulated. Some questions remain in terms of implementing FSMA. First of all, how is it going to be funded? We at our National Association of State Departments of Agriculture have been very, very clear that federal funds need to be the source of funding for implementing this act. The state departments of agriculture are going to play a role in doing this work, especially on-farm inspections, but all of us have made it clear that we will not be doing that work unless federal funds come forward. And Congress is in the middle right now of debating initial funding for implementing FSMA. Some more to come on that. The second issue is what will be the role of the State Department of Agriculture? And we're really outreaching right now to the produce community to ask them, what do you want us to do? There's an education component to this. There's an outreach and technical assistance component. And then there are on-farm inspections. And are they interested in having the Department of Agriculture conduct those on-farm inspections, or do they want the Food and Drug Administration to do that? Somebody is going to do it. And I think people get nervous about having the State Department of Ag conduct that role, but at the same time, I think they really don't want the FDA on their farm. So much more to come on that here in the next few years. The second topic that I will touch on, clearly the change in climate. We mentioned the impact on snowpack and water. The other big issue for us is around invasives. And we talk about invasives a lot in this committee, whether that's plant pests, diseases, weeds, you name it. We're more than likely to see more and more of that impacting Oregon agriculture and how we deal with those new pests, disease, and weeds will continue to be a challenge. We will be back in front of you in November with more information about it, but as an example, for those of you that live in the Portland area, this year we found a number of both European gypsy moths and Asian gypsy moths. And we are working now to try to figure out the best way to deal with those gypsy moths. Those of you who have been around for a long time and in the forest industry know that if you let this pest get out of hand, what it can do to our forests and our trees and shrubs in our backyards. A couple of those moths were found in Forest Park. That's not going to be fun for anybody. So we'll be back in front of you, and you'll be hearing about this a lot. And then finally, on the invasives and climate front, I would also mention fire. Mr. Chair, you made some remarks opening up, and the fires that we saw this year impact not only forestry but also agriculture, in particular our cattle industry, because many of the grazing allotments that cattle producers have are in forested areas and are severely impacted by fires. We know that just as 3 years ago, a lot of federal allotments were burned out. We have the same results this summer, and so that poses a big challenge for cattlemen in terms of where they're going to graze their cattle in the next few years. So those are big issues for us. Transportation. The governor has started a strategic initiative around transportation issues. We had hoped to have a hearing tomorrow morning on this topic. We're going to have to postpone it till November. But as we had mentioned, being able to move agricultural products to market is absolutely essential for the 80% of our products that leave our state and move into international markets. We all experienced firsthand what happens when that system breaks with the West Coast port slowdown last year. Huge impact on moving agricultural products out of the state. Many vivid stories. Probably the one that's most vivid is Christmas trees that got stuck on the dock and we're still sitting there in January. That doesn't work very well for a Christmas tree grower. And so the effort around what we do with transportation from a West Coast perspective, as well as the challenges that we're facing in the Port of Portland, very, very important to the agriculture industry. We're a partner in this effort with ODOT, with Business Oregon, and the Port of Portland. There are no easy answers here, but clearly this is an area where we need to pay attention and make some new investments in terms of transportation. We have
Excuse me. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And thank you, Director Koba. I wanted to just assure you that the hearing that we had scheduled for tomorrow was incredibly important from my perspective as chair of that committee. And I just wanted you all to know that we had to move that to November. One of the key presenters in that hearing scheduled for tomorrow had a death in the family, is not able to be here for personal reasons. So we're going to move the whole thing to November so we can have a comprehensive look at this. And I greatly appreciate in your priorities under transportation, your calling out of the importance under the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee preserving rail infrastructure and looking at the issue of transload rail to truck somewhere downstate so that we can move those products either north to south and get them out in a very swift and efficient manner. So I just want you to know it's high on the radar. It will come back in November, and there was a very good reason why we had to move that hearing to November. But thank you for your patience in allowing us to provide him an opportunity to be with his family. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. We in the industry received some really good news last week or the week before. It all starts to blur together, but that was the fact that the sage grouse was not listed by the Department of Interior as a threatened or endangered species. Huge kudos, frankly, to the team and the work that went into all of the efforts to which ultimately prevented that listing. But I think that doesn't mean that there isn't work going on the ground, and there won't be an incredible amount of work going on the ground to restore sage grouse habitat. I need to do a call out to the ranching community in Oregon, which really stepped up to the plate and I think is a leader, frankly, in the western states in signing candidate conservation agreements with assurances. Our partners in soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, the incredible amount of financial support given by the federal government, and the work that many of my sister agencies have done on this yeoman's effort. Certainly Richard Whitman and his leadership on this. It's an example of how we want this to work when we're dealing with endangered species issues. So great news, and hopefully it's a model that we can use in other places. Another topic that, frankly, I would say is probably taking up the majority of our time right now in terms of the director's office and the Department of Agriculture, and that's cannabis and how we move forward on recreational marijuana legalization, on industrial hemp. Another example of some challenging coexistence issues. And so more to come on this issue, and I would just ask that you continue to pay attention to it. This is definitely a change for Oregon agriculture. We are bringing into the fold, if you will, a large number of growers that have not been in the fold before. It's a new customer base for us, and how we outreach and regulate them, I think, will continue to be a challenge moving forward. But we're going to give it our best shot if we can. And then, Mr. Chair, I just want to take this brief opportunity. I think some of you may have received some emails about a recent appointment to the State Board of Agriculture. And that was the appointment of Marty Myers, who's the general manager of Three Mile Canyon Farms in the Boardman area, and some criticism about that appointment. And I just wanted to share with you that when you look at the makeup of the State Board of Agriculture, it is a very, very diverse board. And I think the governor and the governor's office tries to do their very best to continue to represent the diversity of agriculture in this state. It's a 10-member board. There is no way that 10 members can represent the incredible diversity that we have in the state. But I believe the state board currently does a very, very nice job of that. We have two board members currently on the board that are small producers and produce organic products and market their products in state. The remainder are primarily mid-sized family farm operations, and Marty really brings a new perspective in terms of a large agricultural operation, very much involved in food processing and exporting of high-value products outside of the United States. And we had the chance for the board to meet last week in Boardman and got a chance to tour the port of Boardman, or Port of Morrow, excuse me. If you've never had that opportunity, I highly recommend it. It's the newest port in the state. It is now the second largest port in the state. They employ over 4,500 jobs at the Port of Morrow, and many of those are grounded in the agricultural economy in that area. It truly is a remarkable model for rural economic development, and Marty's involvement in that effort, I think, can maybe bring us some lessons and help as we try to develop those opportunities in other rural parts of the state where we desperately need that kind of economic impact. In addition, he is very much involved in the water supply developments going on in that region of the state, which are a priority for this governor and this administration. And finally, Three Mile Canyon Farms is the largest contributor of important protein supplies to the Oregon Food Bank Network. And so I think that Marty Myers will be a very strong representative to the State Board of Agriculture and really rounds out that diversity on the board that we need. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for Director Koba? Representative McEwen, please.
I just have one question, because it's a number that I'm not as familiar with as maybe I should be. But under Oregon Farms 2014, the value per crop land acre at 2,500, how does that compare with our neighboring states? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
and you're welcome
McEwen,
to get back to me if you don't
I'm
have it in your head.
I think I'm going to have to get back to you. Otherwise, it would be a completely guess off the top of my head. So
I'm just curious. Thank you.
Happy to.
Additional questions or comments? Director Koba, you mentioned the impact that a virtual shutdown of the Port of Portland and its ability to transport commodities grown here in the state of Oregon has caused to a number of the farming in the farming community. And I can't talk to virtually anyone in the industry, particularly on the east side, without this subject coming up. And it seems to me that we need a few good people to work this out, because this is a grave, grave injustice to folks who are reliant upon that transportation. And the alternatives just don't pencil out. And I personally believe it's a grave injustice to the economy of our entire state. And I guess more of a comment than a question, but do we have those good people prepared to step up to the plate and help us resolve this problem once and for all?
Mr. Chair, I think that... And hopefully maybe some of you can listen to the presentation that we'll have in November about what's going on with the governor's strategic focus on transportation. That really is it's a wonderful effort. Meetings were held in six different locations around the state to really gather ideas about challenges as well as what's going well. Representative McEwen mentioned one idea that was prominent in a number of places, and that is this transloading site or maybe multiple sites away from the port that can help alleviate congestion and move product. I think we need to have a real thoughtful conversation about where we can make some strategic investments to move some initiatives forward, and hopefully that'll come out of this effort. It would be great to get something going in 2016. This will be a multi-pronged effort. There is no single answer that's going to solve this problem. And the fact of the matter is we need transportation investment in the state beyond just the port issue. There is no doubt about it. And we struggle before the West Coast port slowdown, before the container service pulled out of the Port of Portland, and we will continue unless we have significant investment in transportation infrastructure in the state.
Thank you very much. And Director Koba, I want to let you know that if there is any role for this committee to play in assisting those efforts, please call on us.
Be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further? Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance today. With that, I'm going to call up, please. Let's do just maybe awkward with four people. Let's call up Jenny Dressler and Jeff Stone first, please. And if this is awkward, if you had other people that you were planning on bringing up with you, please feel free. I'm just trying to manage our seating arrangements here.
Ladies first.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. All right, Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is the state's largest general agriculture association, representing approximately 7,000 farming and ranching families and 60,000 members statewide. Thank you for the opportunity to come today to talk about the changing dynamics of Oregon agriculture. I think Director Koba set it up well about how important agriculture is to the Oregon economy. We're the second largest traded sector industry and account for approximately 15% of Oregon's economy. Oregon agriculture is incredibly diverse and dynamic. We have over 225 different recognized commodities, and what you're looking at is a map of different growing regions, which also hold an incredible amount of diversity in each region. Oregon is number one in the nation for producing Christmas trees, hazelnuts, loganberries, black raspberries, ryegrass seed, orchard grass seed, crimson clover, sugar beets for seed, red clover seed, fescue seed, blackberries, boysenberries, potted azaleas, and peppermint. We are number two in the U.S. for production of hops, snap peas, and spearmint. I was going to talk today about a couple of the issues statewide that have impacted agriculture and changed some of the dynamics, and some of it's going to be repetitive from what Director Koba said. But for us, a significant issue has been the loss of the Port of Portland container service. We have a growing demand for Oregon agriculture products in Asia, and we recently lost 98% of our container traffic at the Port of Portland. The next closest container ports are Tacoma, Seattle, and Oakland, and the costs are far higher to get to these ports. Some crops may not be viable for export with these cost increases, and in some cases, there is no alternative domestic market. Worse, these ports may not have the capacity to take Oregon cargo in a timely manner, and rail and road infrastructure is not well suited to moving these ag products to find a new port. Christmas trees, apples, potatoes, they are all affected, as well as hay and straw and many other commodities, by this changing dynamic. Looking at individual commodities, grass seed has recently had a little bit of a change in the Willamette Valley. Oregon is a leader in grass seed production. The grass seed was introduced in the 1920s. And at that time, and up until about 2009, farmers were burning their fields after harvest to kill pests and diseases and to get rid of straw left after harvesting. I believe last session you all heard about the slug dilemma that we are having in the Willamette Valley and the pest issues that we are seeing on a lot of those fields. I guess since 2009, burning has been limited to a maximum number of 15,000 acres per year, and primarily in the Silverton Hills area. So looking at this changing dynamic in grass seeds, some growers have been selling that leftover straw on their field to markets in Asia, and they have been severely impacted by the port shutdown, because that is an incredibly high cost of transportation. I would say others have either continued growing grass seed and they're utilizing different crop protection methods, or they've transitioned to some of the higher value commodities that Director Koba mentioned. I guess as an example, the first one that I was going to mention was hazelnut production, which actually recently underwent its own changing dynamic in that several years ago the industry was in serious trouble due to eastern filbert blight, and this is a fungus that causes infected trees to develop cankers and to eventually killing off their branches. It would take a lot of time and resources for farmers to try to protect, prune their remaining trees, and there still was no, I guess, cure for this disease, this pest. However, recently, after the formation of a commodity commission, years of research has bred a disease-resistant tree that farmers are now able to plant to help ward off this pest. So I would say that's a really positive changing dynamic that this industry has seen, and it's just taken off. The second one is blueberries. We have over 20 different varieties of blueberries in Oregon. And one of the dynamics that I've heard from our growers, not just in blueberries, but in other labor-intensive crops, be that pears or others, is that they have been especially hit by labor shortages. This shortage is driven by many issues, immigration. It was a struggling U.S. economy and even more jobs in other places. But the shortage and competition for workers means that labor expenses have climbed, and that harvests are getting delayed and less fruits and vegetables are being picked. And this is impacting the viability of a lot of these farms who just cannot find labor when they need it. I think that this underscores for Farm Bureau the need for a national solution to immigration to help solve this issue. It's critically important to our industry. So the other issue that we deal with and that Director Koba touched on briefly is coexistence conflicts and how that has started to shape Oregon agriculture. In 2013, the legislature passed a bill creating certain control areas for canola and research for canola to try to deal with that conflict and disallowing the growing of canola outside of a certain area in the Willamette Valley. I think since then, you all heard from the canola growers and the specialty seed industry last session. The research project is going well, and folks are able to grow in the same areas utilizing that voluntary pinning system, which has actually been a pretty neat success. But I think that what we would like to underscore is that picking winners and losers between some of these neighboring farmer groups has kind of spiraled into opening the door for people running to the legislature asking them to solve other neighbor-to-neighbor conflicts. Yeah. And I think I'm really proud of the industry. We had an issue come up between wine grapes and grass seed about the use of herbicides, and the wine grape growers were concerned about the use of herbicides, and we actually had a meeting this summer with the wine grape growers and the grass seed industry, and we toured both farms, and we talked about the different needs, and we are working on a communication strategy that really does help us communicate better to our neighbors and get the message out that my crop is sensitive at this time of year, but you still need this tool. So let's work together so we can both use this effectively. The other issue that was mentioned was industrial hemp and cannabis, which I did not realize that there would be a coexistence conflict until last session when it came up. Apparently industrial hemp, you grow both male and female plants. In cannabis, you're growing predominantly female plants for flower. And the potential cross-pollination could reduce some of the THC or the psychoactive properties of cannabis. So we did have a conflict where there were two grower groups that really had not been formally established in the state of Oregon, and they were running into this question of what do we do, you know? He can hurt me, I don't have any protection. And we really did have a a discussion, and I brought the hemp growers, Farm Bureau brought the hemp growers in, and we had a discussion about how can we minimize impacts to our neighbors. And they did make the voluntary decision, the industrial hemp industry, to grow their male plants indoors this growing year to minimize risk to their neighbors. And it's been a pretty successful year, I think, for that. So when we go into 2016, we're going to be looking hopefully beyond that issue and into some of the issues regarding the actual license and how people are growing industrial hemp, because I think it's a little different than how we envisioned. So
almost looks like we could get a 2x4 or so out of some of those plants.
They're pretty big. a huge issue this year and in years previous for Oregon farmers has been drought. Oregon farmers and ranchers are extraordinarily concerned about drought. Extreme warm weather conditions and water shortages this year have contributed to a much earlier harvest for commodities across the state. Yields were much lower for many commodities in Oregon this year. The drought has also resulted in earlier curtailment than we've experienced in recent memory, and that has resulted in shorter irrigation season, as well as many farmers utilizing fewer rotations, so they're producing less. With a drought declared in 26 Oregon counties, we saw an increase in the use of the Water Resources Department's drought program, which provides much-needed relief for Oregon's drought-stricken farmers. Water shortages change crop choices as well as crop rotations. With the predictions showing that we are heading into another early drought year, it is critical that we work to increase Oregon agriculture's resiliency to drought and look to increase water storage and water resiliency. And the legislature did seed that program with $50 million that we so appreciate to help maintain Oregon agriculture's viability. So kind of stepping aside from some state regulatory and environmental implications on the change dynamics, I wanted to highlight a couple of federal regulations that are going to be impacting Oregon agriculture in a significant way. So the first one is that FDA recently has been undertaking an effort to reduce the amount of antibiotics utilized in food-producing animals. They started this effort in 2013 with guidance document number 213, which includes two components. And the first one is eliminating the use of antibiotics for production purposes, which means that for farmers or veterinarians who are prescribing antibiotics to their animals, both growth promotion and feed efficiency, those uses have been removed from the federal label. And that label is the law. So without having those on the label, and that effort will be completed in 2016, getting all of those antibiotics into compliance, without those on the label, farmers will not be able to use antibiotics for food production or growth enhancement or feed efficiency. Which is a significant change for some regions of the country, I believe, but maybe not necessarily for a lot of Oregon ag producers. The other piece is the Veterinary Feed Directive, which was actually finalized in June of this year, June of 2015, which requires veterinary oversight of any medically important antibiotics administered to livestock via feed or water. So it does not allow, number one, for non-therapeutic uses, but then also provides the flexibility needed to accommodate the different needs that different growers have and the different producers have. The sheep growers have a need for a couple of weeks of preventative antibiotics to prevent mortality in their flocks. So this is a really important issue for them. And the FDA rule did allow for them to use those antibiotics for prevention as long as they're under the oversight of a veterinarian. So we also, Director Koba mentioned the Food Safety Management Act. I think there's some water quality standards that are going to impact a lot of our produce growers, especially dry bulb onion growers in eastern Oregon, who weighed in significantly with in rulemaking for the Food Safety Management Act. There are also some wildlife management rules that are going to be very difficult to manage on the dynamic landscape that we have, because it's very difficult to prevent any birds from flying into a field or any of those wildlife impacts on crops. So the other big issue that we've recently been discussing quite a bit is WOTUS, and that is Waters of the United States. I think that the overall underlying impact for Oregon agriculture is very unknown at this point. We're going to be looking at mapping, but I think that the impact is going to impact the Willamette Valley and much of Oregon And it could impact growers significantly. And I guess we'll be coming to you when we actually have a better read on how growers are gonna be impacted by that. So recently, actually, just the past couple of weeks, we were alerted to a regulation that came down from the Federal Aviation Administration, and that is that on August 20th, they finalized rules, and we were unaware of this. They finalized rules that would change classification for airspace around the Salem and Independence Airport, expanding Class D airspace from about a 5-mile radius to a 16-mile radius, which brings in many of the Christmas tree growers. And the issue here is that we cannot get a rule change or an exemption in time for Christmas tree harvest. And the rule, that expansion of Class D airspace is going to disallow helicopters from harvesting those trees. So we're kind of in a pickle right now. We've been working with the federal delegation on a short-term solution and hopefully putting together. It's a significant strain on the industry, and it's something that we're watching and engaging on. And but something as small as, you know, one line or two lines in a rulemaking can impact an entire industry. And if folks can't get those trees out in time, the Christmas tree industry is going to be hit hard. So that's something that we're trying to engage in a proactive way. But then finally, federal regulations or under federal regulations, I think probably one of the most significant things impacting or changing the dynamics for Oregon Ag is the Endangered Species Act and some of the lawsuits that we're in the middle of right now or just hearing about. FEMA consultation. In 2010, several environmental groups filed a lawsuit against FEMA for failure to consult under the ESA regarding the impact of their operations, unlisted salmon. So FEMA recently settled, and they agreed to initiate consultation with the National Marine Fisheries Service. So the biological opinion is expected to be released next month, and it will require mitigation and restrictions for development in floodplains in Oregon within the 500-year floodplain, which is a new term for me. It could extend miles on flatland. So the ag impacts are going to include dwellings, barns, and other buildings necessary for farm operations, but it's not only going to impact agriculture. This is a big decision that's going to impact cities, counties, all other industries that are within that floodplain. So for us also, the sage-grouse, phenomenal news last week with regard to the listing decision. However, as Director Koba mentioned, people are still going to be protecting the sage-grouse, and they're still undertaking actions, and they're still changing the way that they manage their land in order to protect that habitat and the species. So two other issues that we're looking at right now or that we're hearing about are the streaked horned lark, which is going to impact growers in the Willamette Valley, especially in the grass seed, and then spotted frog, which is a very significant issue for irrigators in Central Oregon who rely on that water for the viability of their operations. So I guess to kind of summarize my presentation, and sorry if I went long, regulatory flexibility is really key. Our industry is so dynamic, and every action that we take in environmental or state regulations, federal regulations, and some of these legal decisions that are coming out with regard to the Endangered Species Act, every action that we take impacts the viability of Oregon agriculture. It impacts what growers are able to grow and the markets that they're able to access. And we are so lucky to have the diversity that we do. So I guess I would just say that we have incredible diversity and an opportunity to contribute to global food security, and I really hope that our message is that we really need that flexibility in order to do that, and that communication. So, thank you.
Very good. Jenny, thank you very much for such a comprehensive and well-done presentation. If you don't mind, I'm going to wait to take questions and comments until Jess finished his presentation. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I serve as the executive director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We don't have coexistence problems with our good friends from beef and calf. We're happy that they're number one. When they win, we all win. So I'm pleased to be here with you today. I have before you detailed comments, which I will summarize, and then I really am more interested in getting comments and questions from you.
Thank you.
So today, I want to try to do something a little different in front of this committee, which is to talk about three areas of focus for us to have this discussion today. And so the three areas of focus are, and a force, you know, the forces that kind of govern the nursery industry are industry, market forces, and then political and regulatory. So first of all, on the industry. It's a misconception that agriculture's a bad job, that it doesn't pay. Nurseries have the second highest average wage for the industry on the continent. We average $10.26 an hour. That's for someone who is unskilled, just walk in saying, I want to be a nursery worker today. And they put you out there and they try to not have you succumb to being outside and actually doing a lot of hard work. So with all that said, the recent recession really forced this industry to look at how you mechanize. The difficulty is that you only can do so much with mechanization with the nursery industry. It still takes hand touch to make that product go. But it doesn't mean that that issue is not one that we need to try to address, because it leads into my second point. There is a labor shortage. The big difficulty is that in agriculture, there's a lot of immigrant labor that participates. Second-generation immigrant labor is not coming to the farm. And so we need to find ways to become more efficient. Nurseries are very good about getting a lot of work on a small piece of land to get a lot of production. But it is a significant issue that is forcing a lot of decisions by the nursery industry now for how it's going to be shaped in the future. We recently had a nursery tour out at Ashragi Nursery in Representative McLean's district. And they talked openly with the legislators that were able to be there, and you have invites to all of them, by the way. Somewhere in your inbox you have an invite. They talked about how they're an $8 million nursery, but they could have done $12 million this year. But they didn't have the labor in order to do it.
That's for the B, billion.
So they are an $8 million with an M.
M, okay.
They'd be super stoked. We would be far beyond Jerome if we were that one industry. $8 billion. But it was
have a little competition going.
There we go.
Let's do it. But
they may raise the prices here, so stop it.
Yeah, that is the difficulty. We'll get into it later. If you read ahead of my testimony, you'll see why that is difficult. But they can't, and this is something that not only does it impact how much they do, but it impacts the nursery product. Is not a strawberry crop. You just can't put it in and generate it. It takes 5 to 10 years. So this particular nursery, from seedling to finished product, was 6 years to get it out the door. Yeah. So they're making that decision now about how they best try to predict what the market's going to be, mm-hmm. plus having the adequate labor to do it. All that would not be even remotely possible if there was not water. Nursery industry is very dependent on water and its availability. So having a discussion amongst cities, amongst agriculture, amongst environmental groups to prevent a war that unfortunately folks like Representative Whitsitt is experiencing down in the Klamath about winners and losers, we'd want to try to prevent that as much as we can elsewhere in the state. And with the snowpack being reduced, those choices are becoming less and less.
Yes.
I give you a lot of credit. You're going to hear a lot of credit from the advocates in this room about your vote for $50 million. I'd say that's the beginning of an investment strategy. But I give you a lot of credit for looking forward and trying to say, how do we address this issue, not only on quality, but also quantity. So I thank you for that. For industry, pest and disease management is a big deal. As temperatures change, we're seeing pests come into Oregon that have not prior been here. We are not happy about the reemersion of the Asian gypsy moth. they love conifers. And so that's bad for forestry, that's bad for nurseries. And so we really take a proactive step to make sure that we do the right things for pests and disease. Because not only do we export so much outside of our state, other states don't like it if we ship something that is infected or has a pest on it. So we're very proactive. Nurseries, by the way, by the places that they're located, are both urban and rural. So we really get that discussion in a very finite point when cities want to expand, but there are nursery lands that are right there that are very productive. Nurseries are industries without walls. And so we really want to make sure that there's a coexistence in that manner about how you have viable agriculture along with community life. So one thing that's coming out of the economic recovery, and I don't want us to skip over it, and then I'm going to move into market forces, is how bad that last recession was for the nursery industry. No one escaped. And for people who represent the more rural communities, you have been living this for a long time, and we got to see it firsthand. We lost one-third of all the nurseries over the last 6 years. A third just gone. I'm in association with members that depend. They're pesticide folks, they're environmental service folks, they're truckers, they're all that. We lost half of our membership, and while maybe that might be more reflected about the type of executive director I am, I think it really was a bigger show of what happened to the economy for the nursery industry. So we were up $60 million this last year. I feel good about that. And our members are getting more confident in how the economy is going to react. Because frankly, what Oregon does is very important to us because we live here. The East Coast matters about our economic springboard more than Malala. So that's why we want to try to continue to grow and ship as much as we can. Market forces. The industry has changed. There's been a confluence of just-in-time ordering from our customers. So it could be a re-wholesaler, it could be a retailer, it could be a landscaper saying, let's say, McLean Farms, we need it next week, not 3 years from now. So I want you to, give me what you got. That type of just-in-time ordering is becoming more prevalent than ever before. I would also say that with the downturn in the economy, shortages have arrived. So when you're barely surviving, you're not planting. And that's just not for this year. That's for, as you heard from propagation to market, that could be 6 years. So you're now affecting the market 6 years from now. So there are shortages, but Oregon really grows nursery crops better than anybody else. And my growers hate this, but we're the Saudi Arabia of growing plants. We can do it, and we have a lot of it, and we can ship it. We can dominate any other state except for California, but you know they get to do whatever they want. Then there's also trade. How do we compete against other states? We compete with a higher wage rate than states that are closer to the markets we serve. So you have Tennessee, you have Georgia, you have the Carolinas, you have Ohio. All those pay a higher average. I mean, we pay a much higher average rate just on our minimum wage alone than they do. So just keep in mind that there's the basic economics of how we compete as a state and how we compete as an industry when it's going in between states serving markets that are farther away from us. So I'm going to skip ahead to transportation. Freight is incredibly important. I never really grasped how important the port slowdown was until my board president called and said, I have trees going to China and they are dead because they've been in a container for 4 weeks. And, you know, photosynthesis, science actually matters, right? So having that happen, we jumped in with a lot of the agricultural groups to try to get that moving. But it is how one pinch point can hurt the whole system. And you're going to have discussions over this next session or two about transportation infrastructure. We stand committed to help you try to get product to market. So transportation muy importante. Okay, that's my only bilingual thing. So political and regulatory forces. Lastly, there are positive, negative, and kind of we're not sure yet. So I have those listed in this area, but I'll point to a couple of the positives. With the immersion of all these pests and diseases, other states use that opportunity to say, Oregon, Washington, California, you ship infected plants. Even though it may be less than 2% actually send something out that's verified as infected, they put a quarantine on the three states. And it was an artificial trade barrier. We went and fought, and we actually wanted to not only beat that back, we wanted to try to work with the USDA and the ODA to create a new system. So now we try to help the growers that have a problem. And you know, it went from everybody being under suspicion to just a few. So we went from a resource management point of view for our inspectors, we went from inspecting everybody five times a year to let's help you get inspected to make sure you're doing your stuff right. But we're going to focus on the ones we're having trouble. So the regulatory side of that went down 98%. And it's considered a success. So the regulatory community can be a positive. So it just depends if how the industries are involved. The last thing is everybody has opinions about the Affordable Care Act. I would say that we need to work with Congress to try to get it so it works better for us. Seasonal employees. Tip a lot of our folks who might be a 35 full-time employee entity with the seasonals will put them over 50. And 50 is the magic marker for the Affordable Care Act, so you can understand why we are paying attention to this. I'm saying this because I think it's incumbent upon state legislators and our congressional members to try to fix these issues so they work in the ways it was intended. So I have members, conservative and liberal. I get to serve them both. They both think I'm wrong at times, which is fine. But this is an example of how we can work together. And then you have others listed in my testimony, Mr. Chair, that I won't go into, but they all can impact. WOTUS is in there. There's a variety of things that are in there that can impact our ability to do the things that we do so well. So at that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much, Jeff. Committee members, questions or comments? Representative Esquivel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Funny that this would come up about the sage grouse, because I was just reading that the federal government is going to withdraw about 1.9 million acres in the state of Oregon as a buffer zone, even though these are not an endangered species in the state of Oregon. Hmm. So the other thing that concerned me about the testimony that we've heard today is the EPA. When are we going to stop them from coming in and taking over our state? We need to have good leadership in this state, and we need to say enough's enough. Who gives them the right, except maybe Congress passed a law, and they're taking that right from the interpretation of the law, but what authority do they have to enforce laws? I believe they have none. So why are we allowing this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, thank you for raising this issue. Depending on where one sits, you can think federal agency outreach can be good or a bad thing. Just yesterday, the worker protection standard was initiated by the EPA. It presumes that agricultural groups are going to put their employees at risk at a higher level than what they have been doing over the last several years. And I would say that the base assumption is one that I don't agree with. And it's going to cost agricultural entities a lot of money to do the things that they already do with their employees, but they have to go through a certain venue. So to answer your question directly is, I think that when you look at Waters of the United States, you look at the Worker Protection Standard, and you can find examples on the other side, Congress has the ability to stop things to happen if the president agrees. And right now you're at an impasse where you have a Congress that believes one thing and a president who believes another.
Yeah.
And it was inverse when George Bush was president and we had a Democratic Congress. So I think it's a worthwhile thing to raise. I think it has implications, and we should not ignore that it doesn't.
Well,
please.
Well, I just feel that we've let the EPA run roughshod over the state of Oregon. First, it was about water clarity, and the quality of water. You remember that in Business and Labor? We had that individual from Seattle that was incredibly pompous. Came in, couldn't talk to him. He didn't want to talk to you. And now I see that they're at it again. And now they're setting aside this land in eastern Oregon and making it off limits for something that we have the largest population of sage-grouse in the western United States. We do not have a problem with sage-grouse in this state. In fact, we could export sage-grouse to other parts of the United States, but we don't, because we haven't had any cooperation from the other states. But I guess I just don't get it, because if it isn't an endangered species, why are we locking down the area?
Representative Barreto.
Didn't want to bite on that one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The nursery business, what percentage of the product goes out of state, and then what percentage of the product is sold internationally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, thank you for the question. Over 80% of the nursery products harvested that year or to market that year go out of state. 50% of that goes east of the Mississippi, just to try to give that a further differentiation. 10% goes out of the country. Now, Canada's still out of the country. There's a big market up in the Canadian province, but I had more delegations from China come in during our trade show this last year wanting to open up trade with the nursery industry in Oregon because of the quality product that we grow.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McClain.
I had a question the other day I couldn't answer, and if it's in this report, just tell me and I'll look for it. But how many of in the nursery stock, how many are container versus, you know, in the ground, soil planted?
My very first, Mr. Chair, Representative McClain, my very first time testifying in front of a committee was with Senator Beyer, who's back here, and he goes, why in the heck would you put gravel on perfectly good farmland and put pots on it? And Senator Beyer's a good friend of the nursery industry, and I think I was being hazed. It's about 40% for the container. And that's often because you will recycle water because you can do drip irrigation, and it's a more efficient way of trying to pot. You can size up plants. The difficulty with and it's different types of production. So the infield, they will often take those out and try to put them in pots, or they do what they call ball and burlap, which they put burlap over it. But you can get fewer trees onto a truck because often it's weight-based and size-based. So if you're going to do ball and burlap, it usually has something that has a decent caliber size. Did I answer your question?
You did, and you made me think of another
one. Think of four
so what,
others. Yes.
What you did, though, was give me an idea that what you're talking about is also the size and the type of product, because it would seem that some would be more for container sizes than large containers, which would have the same issue as the burlap sacks. And
Mr. Chair, Ursula McClain, very briefly, Ashragi Nursery this last week showed where their loading dock was, and a truck was actually being loaded. And they said, well, how many plants can you put in there? Well, the little one-gallon plants, you can get up to 10,000 plants on that thing. That their mouths dropped wide open. They didn't realize you could get that many. With ball and burlap, it is far fewer. Thank you for the question.
Friends, thank you so very, very much for your presentations. Truly appreciated. And as we're thinking about the next session, if you have issues that you think that we need to be addressing, please let us know. Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Jerome Rosa and Blake Rowe. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome back to our committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Before we get started, I'd like to thank Representative Esquivel for his comments. I'll be discussing that a little bit for another day. I decided just to bring up our four main issues that we're talking about in the cattleman's industry today. And so, and those four issues that we'll be talking about today is sage grouse. I didn't realize so many people are going to be talking about my issue already, but that's okay. Wolves, which we're sure grateful for all that Representative Barreto has done for us on that issue. Wildfire, and of course, then we'll be talking about LOTUS, and this is a huge issue to the cattlemen's organization. My name is Jerome Rosa. I'm the executive director. We have a roughly 10,000 producers in the state of Oregon, of which nearly 2,000 are a member of Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We were established in Baker City in 1913, and as you've heard, we were a $922 million industry this year. We're hoping not to be a one-year wonder, but the price of meat is dropping. So, so the first thing we'll be talking about today is sage grouse. So as most of you heard, in September, just last week, the bird was not listed due to efforts by ranchers, conservationists, and government entities. A large part of this is because, and Katie Koba discussed this a little bit, CCAs and CCAAs. And what these do is aid in the protection of the habitat and species. CCAs are for federal agencies. CCAAs are producer assurances. Examples of those are phylagery using sustainable grazing practices that provide covering for the sage grouse and native grass restoration. There's approximately 165 million acres in the western United States that did CCAs and CCAAs. Oregon, Washington, California, Nevada, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Juniper removal is a big part of the success of the sage grouse. The problem with junipers in the state, and they're becoming overwhelming, and a lot of work has been done, is they provide prime housing for predators, particularly ravens, that'll go in and attack, you know, the eggs of the bird. Water conservation is another benefit of juniper removal. We found that when these juniper trees are removed, we'll get a lot of grass that'll be coming up, and they're a huge user of water in the state. And so the removal of that is really providing a lot more grass available in the industry. And a positive economic impact. This has been a win-win situation. There's a new business in Portland, most of you know, that's making furniture out of juniper, and so it's been a real economic impact driver in the state. Next subject I'll be talking about is wolves. So the wolf plan is due this year for renewal as part of the five-year plan. It was done in 2010. Recently, we've had conversations with conservation groups. Would like to really see the plan renewed before 2016. It's been a real challenge for the Department of Fish and Wildlife with the funding that they have. Currently, there's four breeding pairs in the state and an estimated 79 wolves. And all of these have met the criteria for the wolf plan. A delisting decision will be made by ODFNA, ODFNW, at the November meeting in Salem here. There's another meeting next week. I believe it's the 7th down in Florence. And they'll be accepting comments regarding the delisting process. Currently, we have met the criteria for delisting. Wildfire.
I have just you said there was four breeding pairs. Now that sounds like that's eight wolves. Is that right?
Yeah.
What are the other 71 doing? They're breeding. Let's come on. Let's quit being funny. Maybe they're not quite mature, but the majority of them are going to be producing. Kid ourselves, and it needs to be said.
We can have a long discussion about that, Representative Greger, offline anytime.
And if I could interrupt just for a moment, Representative Barreto, I think, has a question.
Yeah, the Wolf Plan called for a four breeding pair for three consecutive years, which they have met. Now they have 7 to 9 breeding pairs that they've confirmed. And so the four up there was what was required to go to stage two or phase two.
Two different packs in Southern Oregon now.
There you go.
Wildfire, 576,901 acres were estimated burned in Oregon this year. $211 million spent on wildfires. A large part of the problem with this is restrictive single-use management plans. Instead of being able to be multi-use plans, for instance, recreation and grazing, several of the agencies are restricting these plans, requiring them to be single-use plans, and this is having a huge impact on our state's economy. We need to improve the coordination between fire agencies and rangeland fire protection associations. Some of you may not be familiar with rangeland fire protection associations, but these are individual efforts in several of the counties in eastern Oregon. They've gone out and got a massive amount of equipment on their own, and these guys are modern-day heroes. They're fighting the fires on the ground. They're keeping the cost down to our government, and they're protecting their land because the job just wasn't getting done as well as we needed to.
Vice Chair Krieger.
That's the cost of fighting the fires. Do we have any estimate of the loss of timber, grazing value, homes, infrastructure? I would expect it would probably exceed that.
I would expect that, yeah. We can get that information.
And we need to be talking about that because costing a certain amount to fight a fire, but people's lives are totally wiped out from the mismanagement a lot of times of federal land.
It's getting more and more difficult on a regular basis for our producers to get permits on BLM ground and forestry. More and more difficult. And if we can keep those fire loads down, we can really help with this situation. But it's getting more and more difficult for our industry to be able to do that. OCA member experience with local decision making on firefighting strategies. I had a producer that approached me. We had our quarterly meeting in Klamath Falls last week. And there was a new person that was in charge of the firefighting strategies in his area who was inexperienced with the landscape. Often these kind of positions are grandfathered in or rewarded, and people are getting these positions that don't have experience with the landscape and know what's going on in those local areas. And he literally pleaded me to come to the legislature and say, hey, look, we need guys that know what's going on in these canyons and can effectively go in there and fight these fires. Waters of the United States came up briefly today. I was kind of jumping up and down in my chair when I heard Representative Esquivel's comments. This is a huge issue. I heard comments from the state yesterday on this issue, which were really, really disturbing to us. So the National Cattlemen's Beef Association has filed suit against EPA regarding WOTUS. Our cattlemen wanted us to do more. And so OCA joined a suit against EPA in reference to WOTUS, pursued by the Pacific Legal Foundation in Seattle. And we joined state associations in talking with other directors who come from similar political climate states like we are in Washington, California, and New Mexico's cattlemen's associations have also joined into this suit with Pacific Legal. We are concerned with the overreaching authority that WOTUS provides the federal government with. So states that have joined Oregon in WOTUS. And yesterday, during testimony, the states weren't known. So I wanted to make sure that everyone here knew the seven states that have joined on to WOTUS. Oregon, of course, being one of them. New York, Connecticut. I had a long conversation with Hawaii's executive director. They're trying to get on the lawsuit with us. Massachusetts, Vermont, Washington State. We had long conversations with their executive director. And, of course, the District of Columbia. So how will WOTUS affect citizens? This will allow the EPA to regulate all water in the U.S., no matter the size. So the potential here is unbelievable. And Representative Esquivel, thank you for your comments, because you touched on something that we have been fighting and putting money into as an organization dramatically. That's all I got.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that that overview. I'd like to recognize Blake at this point. And gentlemen, we'll take questions and comments after both presentations. Welcome back to our committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Blake Rowe, and I'm the CEO for the Oregon Wheat Growers League. And yes, just to make sure, I don't always enunciate clearly, that is wheat with a T, not weed with a D. Never used to matter, but it's become a bit more of an issue. So the Oregon Wheat Growers League, we're the oldest wheat organization in the United States. So we date back to the 1920s when growers first started meeting as a group to tackle issues that they felt were really beyond their ability to tackle as individuals. So we have a long history in the state as an organization. So I thought I'd give you kind of an overview, talk a little bit about where our markets are, and then try to address directly sort of what's changing and how we're addressing some of those changes. It's not been a particularly good year for Oregon wheat. Typically, we'd see 50 to 70 million bushels in our crop, depending upon growing conditions and how many acres actually get planted. This year, I'd say we'll be probably in the mid-40s, maybe the low 40 million bushel. A lot of that will be what's called high-protein wheat, not necessarily advantageous for the kind of wheat we grow, the soft white wheat that we grow. Second year in a row where we've had issues with heat very dry growing conditions in much of the state. That said, we're still a key part of Oregon agriculture. We're probably one of the most widely grown crops in Oregon, both dry land and irrigated cropland. Roughly 2,000, a little over 2,000 farms that produce wheat. And when you get down to acres, we're probably one of the higher productive areas. So if you count the area that's committed in what we call summer fallow, where a crop is produced every other year, we're probably in the 1.4 to 1.5 million acres of wheat productive area. We are dominated by conventional production. You can see our percentage that goes export is very high. We do have some nice niches for local markets, organic production, specialty production, but when you get right down to it, we are focused primarily on conventional production and very much focused on the export market. From an economic standpoint, we like to think we're a fairly significant part of the overall ag output in Oregon. Over 400 million in direct output on average, and over $800 million in total output. Significant number of jobs. Those are on-farm jobs. Those are also really jobs that run throughout Oregon, through the supply chain, through the transportation chain, through the export in the Port of Portland. It's a fairly wide net that wheat casts in terms of jobs. Typically, we're Oregon's number one or number two exported crop. I think last year we dropped into number two. As Katie said, that's Katie Koba said, that's usually a function of price, although in our case, we've also had a couple of tough years of volume production. And wheat, by tonnage, is still the largest crop at the export from the Port of Portland. By the way, not just from Oregon, but grain from all over the northern U.S., back Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Colorado, all that production largely flows west to the Port of Portland and the ports on the Columbia River. Generally, where our wheat goes, really all over the world, but the dominant markets are probably would probably be Asia and increasingly into Latin America. So we'll drill down on this a little bit. So specific countries, these are the top 10 markets over the last 5 years. Some of our longest, most reliable, most consistent buyers, what we call quality buyers, because they're very much focused on quality wheat, would be Japan, Korea, the Philippines, and more Indonesia. You know, the Oregon growers had fingerprints on opening many of those markets. If you go back into the late 1950s and 1960s, we were some of the first folks to go overseas and work to open those markets to our product. But you'll see in a minute that some of these markets have been under a lot of pressure. So this is looking at the last 5 years, and we'll drill down on this a little bit. So here you can see that we've done a decent job with what we call our regular customers. Those are those long-term quality buyers. They're reliable. They've had a relationship with us, with the Pacific Northwest for many years. We're doing okay there. Our problem is what we call the swing customers, which typically are more focused on price, where we compete on price and not so much on the quality of our product. We've been struggling a little bit in that area. I borrowed a couple of graphs here from U.S. Wheat Associates. They do a lot of marketing work for U.S. wheat overseas. But question was posed to them, so where are we gaining, where are we losing? And it's pretty easy to see. We've had a lot of pressure recently on markets in the Middle East, I'll call it Southern Asia. We have just, frankly, lost those markets. This is one of the areas where you're talking about what dynamic, what are we having to adjust to? This is one of them. I guess on the good side, this is a little bit busy, and I'm not sure that line is statistical, but we have gained market share in a number of countries. Again, you'll see these are probably more in that realm of quality purchasers. They are focused on the quality of our wheat, not necessarily driving for the lowest possible price. Even here, you can see the last couple years have been pretty tough. Okay, so what are we doing to adjust? So we have always had an emphasis on the quality of our wheat, the reliability of our ability to supply, the overall value to our customers. We push this, we work this very hard across the supply chain, from our researchers to what our growers do, to how the supply chain handles and delivers the product, to how the customers see it, and the feedback from the customers back to the research that develops new varieties to make sure that we are targeted. We work this hard, and we've been pretty successful at it. It doesn't come without effort. And now, as you can see, with the price pressures in some markets, the focus on quality is really paid. We've done a fair amount of research on new applications. Soft white really has shown to be very beneficial in blending with other wheats for products that you wouldn't make just with soft white. So soft white might be fine to make sponge cake, but we've also pushed a line of research that you can make better bread. You can have better economics in the bread you make by mixing in a little soft white with other types of more typical bread wheats. That's been a very successful strategy, and we have worked hard to show customers that it can work. Another one, this is particularly in South America, where we have struggled with making particular products out of soft white wheat. And it's another area, particularly it's a soda cracker that's typical in South America. What you find with customers there is they want to be able to make their whole range of products with the wheat that they buy. So being able to unlock, you can make soda crackers with soft white wheat, is very important to opening that market. And again, we've been successful recently. I think we're really gaining ground. The problem here is those two initiatives are somewhat blunted by the fact that our wheat is very high priced relative to other supplies right now. I'll touch on that a little bit more in a moment. And finally, I think we are doing a little better job in our supply chain with doing what's called segregating, which is so wheat that has low protein, making sure that it is held in wheat that's higher protein so that we can match that to customers. Haven't always done that. Some elevator operators have, but we've seen a real expansion of that this year. And long term, it really will improve our ability to match our product to our customers. You don't just buy average soft white wheat. We want you to buy specifically what you want. Second area, research is a big deal. Chair Witt, you touched on sustainability, and sustainability to us is not just what happens on the farm, not just what happens with how it's grown and what inputs we use, but it's also the research, and we depend on that for new varieties, new techniques, precision agriculture, the new chemicals, new fertilizers. There is a tremendous research effort there to sustain our industry. We're now putting about $1 million of grower money through the wheat assessment into research. I'm not sure if that's absolutely the highest, but that's a significant commitment of grower dollars. That's difficult to sustain, particularly in tough years like we're having now. But it really was the only choice we were presented with. We faced about 10 years of steadily declining research funding at both the state and federal level. So we have stepped up, put our money, our money in the breach. We're very active at the federal level. We fought a battle this year to restore a nearly 50% cut to the ARS. That's the Ag Research Facility in Pendleton. We'll see how the federal budget debate goes, but that's an area we put a lot of focus on. I think if things break right, we'll be able to restore that. There's some funding in Corvallis that comes through ARS as well. That's all part of the package. Unfortunately, the reality is we've probably reached about the limit of our ability. I applaud you for the funding that came to statewide this year, the increase in funding, because it's getting pretty tough to backfill. So thank you. Finally, I'll touch a little bit on regulatory issues. I mentioned that our wheat's currently really challenged from a price standpoint. So I'll just use one market. Probably could pick any market, but maybe this is the most extreme, but I think it illustrates the point. So Egypt, long time, has been a fairly consistent buyer of soft white wheat. So right now, wheat is about $5.45 a bushel at Portland, soft white wheat. To be competitive with other suppliers of wheat into the Egypt market, we'd have to be at about $3.90. That's 30%. It's pretty hard to hold your market share. Even though they love your product, at some point, price drives. So that's one of the reasons why you've seen some of our markets really lost, or at least for now. But even in Southeast Asia, we get a higher price than most competitor wheats, and our customers, they're still paying, they still respect the quality, but it's a challenge. And even though wheat prices are down, what we see on the farm is down, we are still a very high price compared to our competition overseas. The translation of that is we can't pass any cost on, just flat. We can't, it just makes it worse. So we're not going to be successful in passing any regulatory cost, any increased cost in inputs. They just, customers aren't going to take it. You've heard some of the issues about costs of new regulations. You know, we've struggled a little bit with some of the policy direction where, you know, it just seems like we're kind of working at cross purposes, but it's certainly an issue. One that you probably haven't heard, with the Farm Bill last year, significant reductions in what we call conservation plans. So the Conservation Stewardship Plan, there's a whole variety of those. Many of them took major acreage reductions in the overall program at the national level. That translates into acres that have been in conservation that will be coming back. That's not good from a conservation standpoint, but it's also more acres that are going to come back into the production stream, and you know, there'll be some adjustment to accommodate those acres. Many of them, it's wheat or nothing. When you get to the dry land, wheat's about the most adapted crop. So I will leave it at that. Happy to take questions. Apologize if I flew through some of that, but yeah. That's a little bit about what we're facing in our production and marketing arenas. Thank you.
Blake, thank you very, very much. Questions, committee members, for either one of our panel members?
Question.
Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Wondering, regarding wheat, if there is a worldwide excess or not, without regard to the price. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal about basically a food shortage in Africa that's expected to kill about 30 million people in the very near future. And they were talking about that they just can't get enough of the basic commodities to feed them. And I was wondering, is it related to price, or is there a glut or not? I mean, obviously it's sort of an environmental and you know, a problem going with the drought there, but also they're indicating they just simply couldn't get the food, even if we wanted to pay for it, to give to them.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, I'm not sure there's a really simple answer. So just to talk about it from a production standpoint, we have had very high wheat production in the world this year. So it's not so much that there's a shortage of wheat, but there certainly is maybe a disconnect in some places at getting the wheat where it needs to go. So I'm not sure exactly if that is a consistent answer, but we've had the fortune this year of, I don't know, from a farmer's perspective, that might not be the good fortune, but we've had plentiful production around the world, very few supply interruptions. Really, the Northwest has maybe been one of the areas that's not had good growing conditions. We've had very good growing conditions in the Midwest and other parts of the world. So we have lots of wheat, but there are areas where getting the wheat, corn, soybeans, whatever product you're talking about, getting it to the people that need it is still an issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is our biggest competition? You saying that we get more for our product because we have a very good product, but still that's going to be tolerated for a certain period of time, and then they'll start going with the price. Who's our competition? Is it Australia, Russia, or Canada?
Yes.
I see.
So Australia is a major wheat producer. Canada is a major wheat producer. What's called the Black Sea, the European Union and Black Sea, they're major wheat producers, major exporters. Argentina is maybe dropped a little bit off the radar screen, but they still, in a good year, produce plenty of surplus wheat. So those are probably the primary producers and exporters of wheat to the world. And, for instance, in Southeast Asia, we'll compete with probably everyone but Argentina. Australia, Canada, and right now, because of low freight rates, wheat out of the Black Sea, we compete with all of those sources right now.
Thank you. Vice Chair McClain.
This is short because I know we're over time for the meeting, but I just, on the second to the last frame on your on your point here on regulatory issues, you had one that was talking about conflicting policy directions.
Sure.
And I don't like to see, you know, policy that's conflicting with, you know, another policy. So if there's one you wanted to call out or...
Well, maybe I give you a short illustration. So a lot of producers have shifted to no-till, what's called no-till agriculture, as a method of increasing soil conservation and increasing organic matter retention. Mm-hmm. If you do that, it's a great strategy, but pretty much fundamental in order to control weeds and other pests, for instance, slugs in the Willamette Valley, you are going to be dependent on the use of pesticides, herbicides. Now, there are folks who say, but I don't want you to use pesticides. Well, the alternative is tillage. Mm-hmm. So if you want more tillage, okay, just make it clear. If you want less tillage, you have to be willing to accept the tools and the methods to apply the trade-offs there with pesticides. If you're concerned about carbon emissions, you don't want us to go back to tillage. So we seem to be concerned about carbon emissions. You see, there,
yeah, I get it.
As we talk about one issue, mm-hmm. we're for, you know, either more or less of it, but we sometimes don't make the connection that there is a trade-off here. You can't have it always.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anything further? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony and your appearance here. And with that, we're going to switch gears to the forest fires. And I'm going to call up first, please, for panel members, Rex Storm, Phil Adams, and Roger Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I think I was elected to go first on this panel, if that's okay with you.
That's perfectly all right. In terms of time, if you could kind of think maybe about 8 minutes apiece, if that's workable, it would be just perfect and allow us maybe a little time for questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I will try to be way under that so the Phil on the far right can have a little more of my time because he's got a great story to tell. So I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and you have a handout coming to you from me. So you asked me to talk about the impact of fire on family woodland owners, and so I will do that, but I'm going to do that kind of in more of an abstract I could give you names and addresses and phone numbers of some of our members who had catastrophic fires on their properties this year. But I think that would kind of be fire is catastrophic in a lot of ways. And while if you are one of those people, and we have a person who lost a million board feet of mature ponderosa pine, he's trying to harvest it now. That's a catastrophic story for him. I have another member who much smaller lost over half of their mature forest. Well, that is clearly is only 100 acres, but that's a catastrophic event for that person. Might not be catastrophic on the landscape level, but statewide this year, the numbers are of approximately 95,000 acres of family forest landowners' property was burned up, compared to the industrial forest land of about 20,000 acres, and that's about 400 family forest owners affected in that manner. So those are the big numbers, but really the numbers are bigger than that when you look at the cost of these fires statewide. So the cost of Oregon's complete and coordinated fire system, and you'll probably hear more of that about that from the Department of Forestry people here, but we have a system that's unique in the West of how we fight fires and who pays for the fight in those fires. And what I handed out to you is just some information about that. So page two of it is kind of a comparison between the different states of how they all pay for their fires. You can see Oregon at the top. We are at the basic level, we are funded 50-50. At the emergency level, the landowners participate at that level up to $10 million. In the past, that was 50%. This year, you will hear that the insurance deductible was raised significantly above that, so it's no longer 50%. But you will see that we are the only state that the landowners participate in that catastrophic level. As many states pay for the basic level, the landowners share the cost, but Oregon landowners are unique in that. What I'd like to show you on page three of what I handed out is a chart talking about the last two fire seasons, not 15, but 14 and 13. And you will see the cost of the 10 most highest fires in the state and the impact of those 10 most highest fires. And I'm going to point you right to the bottom. You will see lightning caused the cost. 84% of those fires were lightning caused. Human caused, which a non-operator, was about 14%. And operator caused was 2.5%. So you see the forest landowners and their operators are not causing these catastrophic fires, but yet we are paying for them. We are paying for them because what you'll see in those costs, I would like to point out, that is not the cost, as Representative Krieger said earlier, that is not the cost of the landowners of what was burned up. This is strictly the cost of what it costs to put out the fire. What is burned up is what would be, I don't know how many factors are higher than that when you talk about loss of timber, loss of homes, loss of rangeland, loss of productivity. And we will hear from Mr. Adams later, loss of time. When you burn up a 20-year rotation or 20-year-old plantation, you've lost not only that plantation, but you've lost the 20 years it took to grow it and the 20 years it takes to replace it. So you're put 40 years behind the ball there. So anyway, that's what that chart is for. Finally, on the back page, the cost to landowners what this is 10 years of the rate that private landowners pay for forest protection. So when a fire happens in an area, whether it be Central Oregon or Southern Oregon or Northwest Oregon, the landowners have all paid for the basic fire support, but also a part of that cost is the cost of putting out that large catastrophic fire. And the system we have built is that the landowners pay the year following that fire. So if you look down, this chart gives you the rates that these different landowners have paid for the last 10 years per acre. So look at Hood River County. You'll see from 2015 to 2016, the rate jumped from $1.69 per acre to $2.09. They had a large catastrophic fire in the Hood River area in the fiscal year 2015. So you see their rates go up 40 cents per acre. And that's across, so you have landowners who their land wasn't touched at all, but now the impact to them is catastrophic, because in Central Oregon now, many landowners, their property tax that they're paying for the cost of fire protection is higher than all the rest of their property taxes combined. And they're in an area where there is no infrastructure left for their product. The person I told you about who lost 2 million feet of ponderosa pine, he is trying to harvest that and salvage it right now, and he can't find a mill that will take it. He's got about 1 million board feet left to salvage. He's got loggers ready to do it, but he can't find a mill that's willing to take it because there's just no infrastructure left in eastern and central Oregon to accept that kind of volume in those kind of areas. So when you talk about the cost to private forest landowners, it's not just the cost to put out the fire. It's not just the cost of the lost productivity. It's the annual cost every year paying these firefighting bills. And then when even if you don't have a loss, you're paying for something that has no value because the infrastructure there isn't left to sell the product. That's why you're seeing policies that are forcing some of these people in Central Oregon specifically, but in Northeast Oregon also, and Klamath also, they're contemplating, can they afford to continue to own timberland? Because if you look, one thing you'll notice is the grazing land rate is usually about half or less of the timberland rate. So if they are to cut their trees and turn it into grazing land, it then becomes their firefighting costs are half or a third the cost. But that's not a public policy the state of Oregon wants, is people converting from forest land to grazing land. I don't think that's what we want environmentally. I don't think we want it socially. So I think this is something, and the forest industry of Oregon, I'm just about done so we can have more time for others. The forest industry in Oregon, OFIC, Small Woodlands, Department of Forest, we've all committed to sit down in the interim and talk about forest fire funding and have a relook at it. But one thing we need to be on the table is a policy that the legislature let go a few years back, which was reforestation tax credit, which at the time it wasn't well used because we'd been in a period of low fire seasons for multiple years. Now, after the last 3 years, this reforestation tax credit, which would be a big help to forest land owners who have lost that forest land, allow them to get back into forest land and at a reduced cost. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions. Probably won't let the panel finish and go from there. Thank you.
We will. Thank you very, very much, Roger. Who's next? Rex?
Chair Witt and the committee members, my name is Rex Storm. I work for Associated Oregon Loggers. We represent some just over 1,000 forest contract companies that harvest and deliver forest products to Oregon's timber manufacturing sector. I'll just hit on a few points. I want to reassure you that the landowners and the industrial forest operations cause very few forest fires. Oregon's effective industrial fire prevention program limits forest landowner operation caused fires to less than 5% of the annual wildfire acreage that occur on ODF protected forests. In this year to date, it's been less than 3%. This abnormal fire season has caused the shutdown of forestry field operations due to lengthy industrial regulated fire shutdowns. Oregon's fire shutdown regulations are the most stringent, the most rigorous in the western United States. During dry conditions, Oregon's complete and coordinated forest protection, forest prevention program includes these regulated shutdowns of operations. And that includes cutting, yarding, loading, transportation, and building and maintaining roads. These lengthy fire shutdowns during this fire season has resulted in irreplaceable loss of Oregon timber supply delivered to market. Let me give you some estimates that we've calculated. The harvest production loss this year to date has been 181 million board feet of lost production. That translates into 36,000 truckloads of logs. The volume loss percent over the total statewide annual harvest over the course of the year is estimated at 4.39% of production loss. A normal year, in a normal fire season, we would see about a 1% loss of due to these harvest fire protection shutdowns. So we're approaching 5%. What is the economic effect of these production losses to Oregon? These losses transcend the forest sector and go far deeper. Job losses from timber harvest not entering the market translates into over 1,900 jobs lost, annualized. That's gone because of gone timber supply that is not produced and entered into the market. This also translates into less secure forest sector employment, increased unemployment burdens for the state. It also results in scarcity of logs and scarcity of operator capacity, plus disrupted log flows, all combining to raise the price of resources in short supply. Costs will increase, and they are increasing. So, economically speaking, we are seeing reduced payroll, reduced income, and reduced profit for the forest sector businesses and its workers. And that translates into something important to you, which is lower income taxes paid by the forest sector due to less production. So in closing, I'd just like to close with and finish with an emerging issue to make you aware of, and that is combustible federal forests. Hazardous federal forests inflame fire behavior and do impact their non-federal neighbors. Private forest land cooperators are increasingly concerned about the emerging impact on private forest lands of the worsening combustible condition of neighboring federal forests and the cost that translates into for their non-federal neighbors. So in closing, I would like to say that the greatest forest fire hazards facing Oregon today are, one, public-caused fires, two, combustible federal forest, three, lightning-caused fires, and four, drought. Now, the first two are manageable, and those are where we should put our focus towards, because we're handling the others fairly well. So public forest, public-caused fires, and then those combustible federal forests are two areas I think of looking towards the future and concentrating our policy efforts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, Phil Adams with Roseburg Forest Products. I'm the land and timber manager for the company. I've met you, Representative Frederick, down on the legislative tour of Stouts Fire. Thank you for your time. I wanted to come today and give you some context on a company's perspective of the Southwest Oregon large fires and their impact to our bottom line. To do that, let me give you a little context about Roseburg. We're a 75-plus year fully integrated forest products company. We have manufacturing in Douglas County, Coos County, and now Jackson County. We're the largest employer in Douglas County, and we support our operations with a very well-managed commercial timberland base that adds value to that operation, and that's what I wanted to comment on today. Unfortunately, I've been in front of this committee now. This will be my second time. I started in 2013 with Douglas Complex, and it seems like we're the poster child for private landowner involvement in large fires. So this is our third year in a row having a large fire on company ownership, starting with the Douglas Complex in 2013, Yellow Point Fire in 2014, and now the Stouts Fire in 2015. A large amount of acreage involved, 15,000, almost 16,000 acres total when you round it up. Put that in context, you're looking at about 25 and a half square miles of forest land involved in large fire. And I really want to point your attention to the column to the right and build on Rex's comments. When you look at the cause of these fires, they're not from our own fault, but rather indirect causes, I would say, that line up with the statistics of fire initiation in Southwest Oregon. Douglas was out of our control as a large lightning caused event. Yellow Point and Stouts were human caused. Yellow Point was actually malicious arson, and Stouts was just human negligence. And so that's a really important part of our story, because what we're seeing is this trend towards large fires in southwestern Oregon, starting with these indirect ignition sources and then coupling with other factors, extreme fire weather, receptive fuels that are initiating these fires, and then preventing initial attack, confinement. And then these large fuel loads on the federal forest lands are compounding the entire issue and creating intense fires that, for lack of a better word, I call firestorms. And these are really events of really moderate to high fire intensity and damage. And so just in picture form, a really unique set of photos that I've put in my library are these high oblique photos of air tankers coming onto the fire scene and pictures out their right-hand windows showing these large firestorm events in full action. Douglas Complex on the left, Stouts on the right. You can see, I hope you can appreciate the scale of what you're looking at there. That orange look down at the base of the column are these large crown fires that I'm talking about, with flame lengths literally 100 to 300 feet in length. Just strong, powerful phenomenon that when they get to this stage of the game, they're beyond human control. No more examples of this large fire event that we're seeing. Large columns equal high intensity fire. This is the worst case scenario for fire managers and land managers alike. When we see smoke columns like this, we know that bad things are happening down on the ground. And I've been talking about how these fires are so hot For the last 3 years, I've been looking for the physical evidence to really bring it home, and I finally found it, unfortunately, here on Stouts. How hot is hot? Think 1,221 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the melting point of aluminum. On the left-hand side, you'll see we went into Stouts, so we had a permanent research plot where we were measuring the growth of those trees, and on each of those trees before the fire, those numbered trees, was an aluminum tag attached to the side of the tree with an aluminum nail. After the fire, we couldn't find those aluminum tags, but that photo on the right shows an example of one example where we did find kind of the remnant molten slag of that aluminum tag and nail on the tree. And I throw it out there just to demonstrate these fires are hot. If you're the poor guy that has his land involved in these firestorm events, you're the loser, because they really take over, and regardless of age, class, or ownership, the destruction in these firestorm zones is amazing. And the common denominator of these large fires as it relates to Roseburg is we're that poor sap loser. Unfortunately, our lands have been at no fault of our own, in the wrong place at the wrong time. 10,000 of our 16,000 acres involved in fire are in these firestorm zones. 7,500 of that 10,000 are what I would call our high-value growing stock pre-merchantable age classes. There are 10 to 30-year-old trees that were part of our future growing stock and our future value. It's a huge loss, and we'll see that as I quantify this later down the road. And just a note to Rex's point, a concern of ours is our land base is in the ONC checkerboard.
If I could interrupt, please. Representative McEwen has a point, I think.
Sure.
Sorry.
I had a constituent ask me a question the other day that I could not answer. Maybe you can help me with it. Does the fact that these are these incredibly hot firestorm events have anything to do with how the forests that are adjacent to your management system are managed?
Well, as I was explaining in my setup, and we could spend a lot of time on this, but what's happening, Representative McEwen, is that we're finding the wrong day to have large fires, and when we get fire that escapes initial attack and it gets on the landscape and it spreads, it's getting into these, at least what we're experiencing on the fires that we're involved in, it's getting into these federal old growth types and like successional reserves with the huge fuel loads in them. And that's kind of the 1-2-3 punch, the final punch, if you will, that's elevating these fires into the crown fires.
Okay.
And once we get these large fires in that crown fire stage, that's when the real destruction hits. And so I hope that helps.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Thank you. That question came up, and I didn't know how to answer it, so thank you.
Thank you. So just a couple of pictures of what these firestorm areas are really looking like. At the landscape level, they're truly catastrophic events. We can all mourn the social and ecological loss in that landscape. This is a picture of Cow Creek Canyon in the Douglas Complex in 2013. Significant catastrophic event. Here I am in Stouts Creek at the bottom of the drainage, just giving you a flavor for that dead and black and dead forest that's a result of these firestorms. Our business model revolves around having a green and growing forest. When the forest turns dead and black, it puts us in a really bad position that we have to make a decision on. Our operating plan for this drainage, here I am on top of Stouts Creek looking now down where I started initially, is down at the base of that drainage. And you can only imagine, this is a 6,000 acre drainage. We own 3,000 of it in our managed forest. It's been completely wiped out. our operating plan has drastically changed, and it changed the day that the fire hit. And so we have to make a decision right now on what we're going to do. Of course, we're going to do the right thing, and that's to restore our lands to productivity. But I threw this picture in there. If you haven't seen a picture of an engraver beetle, it's pretty striking. We found engraver beetles in our stands literally 3 weeks after the fire, and it just reemphasizes to me the landowner at this point in time, if he's going to do the right thing to get his land back into productivity, time is not his friend. It's actually his enemy. We have to do things fast, and we have to do things robustly. And that's when you get to the number slide of this thing. That's the setup I really want to summarize with here today. The cost of large fire, we really spent some time trying to quantify this. We put on our budgeting hats, our financial and market analysis hats, and really summarized the cost to roads in three major dumps or categories. The first is hard costs. The way I would explain it is we're taking 30 years of scheduled costs from our green and growing forest that we had scheduled over time for harvest, reforestation, and future growth. We're funneling that down into a five-year period of capital outlay just to get back to square one. And it's a real cost at the low end. For all of the fires that we're involved in, we're projecting $12 million on the high end because we're working our way through Douglas Complex, but Stouts is now additional to this. Our exposure is as high as $15 million in total reforestation, road repair, road construction costs. Add to that a really easy industry standard appraisal analysis of our investment loss. As soon as our green and growing forest turned black and dead, we immediately lost market value. And we've gone through a fairly straightforward process to determine that market value loss. And then the third real cost to a integrated company like Roseburg is the result of the fire is I actually blew about a 180 million board foot hole into my harvest schedule. And somehow my mills want that volume. I'm going to have to replace it. And to do that, it'll be an incremental cost. We'll have to go out into the marketplace and probably buy volume when those mills need it at a higher rate than we could have produced it internally. That's a real cost. We reflect it. So you put all three of those costs together on a total enterprise perspective. Those numbers may be staggering to you. They're not to us. $33 to $39 million is a reasonable estimate of where we're at. So that concludes my presentation there. I did want to add a couple of things, just a secondary message, if you will. So we're rebuilding our forests a day at a time, a tree at a time, an acre at a time. And that's ongoing. My overarching message to you, it echoes Rex's, and it may echo other folks in the room here, but we're really advocating active management here. We're going to accomplish our goals through active management, the tried and true principles that can restore a forest. Our concern is that we're not seeing that from the federal ownership at this time. We're not advocating that they, at this point in time, employ the tactics that we do, but there's certain elements of active management that they can and should employ, especially in these catastrophic fire areas. And we want to be part of that conversation, that policy change, and that discussion going forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes, and the one thing probably that you didn't mention there is the extensive damage to the environment that it goes beyond the actual burned out area, the salmonids that we're spending billions of dollars trying to save or whatever, the erosion into the streams. I mean, it's untold environmental damage, so much more than sustainable harvest could ever dream of doing. These fires are just wreaking havoc on the environment. And this is a thing I don't think people really understand out there. There's sort of this logging is bad thing. Logging is not bad. Forest fires are just total destruction of everything for years and years to come. I mean, depending on the kind of winter that we get, or winters until this is replanted, the amount of silt and mud down these streams all the way to the ocean, it's just going to be terrible.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Very quick question. Do you have a sense from the three fires that you were commenting on that have impacted your land, how many million metric tons of carbon were released into the air?
Oh, geez. Chair Witt, Representative McEwen. We haven't done that, Candy. I mean, we're really good at quantifying kind of the conventional business piece of this, but you're right. I mean, smarter minds than mine. And certainly it should be calculated because it's huge. You know, when you look at those smoke columns that I showed and those Ohio bleak pictures of those firestorm events, we were getting meteorologist reports on Stouts as an example that smoke column was pushing 40,000 feet into the air. That's a tremendous volume of carbon dioxide that's being released.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
I happened to be leaving Agnes and heading towards Coos Bay the day the Biscuit Fire blew up, and I stopped up at the top of the Rogue Drainage and was heading down into the Coquille Valley to let my dogs out and look back, and you could see that column start to rise. I didn't know what it was at that time, and I stopped and took photos of it, and I had them on my computer for a long time. And there was a calculation done of the amount of carbon that was released into the air with the Biscuit Fire, and it was staggering. Compared to geologic events such as volcanoes. I mean, it was absolutely staggering what we're doing by not managing these correctly.
So. Chair Witt and Representative McEwen, and that's our point, is we have to, as Oregonians, as landowners, as fire managers, we have to find a way to break this trend of large fires, especially on the west side, because they're so destructive. You can see the loss of value to a private landowner. You can also calculate the environmental and social loss with other metrics. Well, too.
Thank you for being
thank
here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we had that discussion about the Biscuit Fire in the committee of ours, I think about 6 or 8 years mm-hmm. ago, something like that.
Yep.
And it was stated at the time that there was enough CO2 footprint that when it burnt, it was the equivalent of everyone in the state of Oregon driving their car for 10 years.
Wow.
But with the decaying timber and lumber that was laid and we weren't able to salvage much, it was the equivalent of everyone driving their car for 100 years.
Wow.
Now, I can take you down to Southern Oregon and show you units where BLM has a unit and Boise has a unit side by side. They were logged at the same time. That looks just about like BLM's.
Well, Representative Esquivel.
It wasn't a fire, it was just poorly done.
Well, so what I'm actually showing there, in fact, is I'm comparing what I know about Rabbit Mountain, which is a fresh fire that's in its early stages of non-management and decay. But on the right-hand side, to your point, is an example taken in 2013 at the time of the Timber Rock Fire, a decade post-fire on federal lands, kind of representing that snag patch and brush field look that we see on Timber Rock, that because of non-salvage and that late successional reserve land use allocation. And that's the trend we're seeing, and that's so alarming.
These units were right next to one another, and the BLM unit looked like somebody had not done anything, which they hadn't.
Yeah.
And then the Boise unit was a vibrant forest. And it's my understanding that Boise was spending about $400 an acre to get that forest like it was. BLM had spent almost $1,500 an acre for a brush pile. So yeah, we've got to change our practices.
Mm-hmm. We're in lockstep with you.
And following up on Representative Esquivel's questions and comments there, Phil, what does your company do? You showed slides of standing dead forest. What does Roseburg Lumber do on those timberlands?
So right now, from an operational point of view, our engineers are out evaluating. We break our forest into two components, our merchantable timber component and our pre-merchantable timber component. Merchantable timber isn't age-driven so much, but volume per acre-driven. Those stands that if we entered them today, well, they were still growing, but they're dead now. But if we entered them today, we could economically harvest those trees and remove them from the forest and send them to the mills. And so the answer to your question is we're repairing our roads so that we have safe access to the forest. We're salvaging as much of our merchantable timber component as we economically can. We're evaluating the economics of salvage harvest in our pre-merchantable timber just as a silvicultural prescription to get the trees off the ground or out of the air and off the site. But after that, all of our net forest acres, we're going to just put back into production by planting. And so a 10-year-old stand, as an example, that has a 20-foot tall tree in it that's skeletonized and standing today. That's why I showed that picture, if you will, of the tree planters down in there. As an example, that's the best we can do at this point in time. And our experience tells us from past experience that we'll be successful in that. It looks stark, it looks a little draconian, but we know over time that we can get young trees to grow in that kind of environment. So that's what we'll do.
That previous slide that you had taken in 2002,
this one here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you were to clear that, yes. Active management, I think, is, I can't remember which one of you advocated that.
We're both advocating
okay.
it, by the way.
So active management, you site prepare that, you've planted it. 13 years later, what are we looking at in terms of forest stock?
Oh, on these sites down here, they're surprisingly productive. You may associate Southwest Oregon as low productivity in terms of timberlands. We don't. They're moderately productive. At age 13 on a site like Rabbit Mountain and even Timber Rock, you would have a 25-foot-tall, thriving, green and growing forest. And that's what I say to you folks is come back to Rabbit Mountain, Douglas Complex, Stouts a decade from now. You'll see a green and thriving forest on our sites because of that conscious effort to reinvest and get those acres back into productivity.
So, Phil, I want to make a point here. That thriving forest that you just described, describe what this is for us, if you would, please. What
pictures?
What is that? What does that represent in terms of a threat and an opportunity?
Yes. From the federal perspective, that is the ecological approach to successional restoration on their lands. It's current policy that other than non-discretionary acts such as salvage for hazard tree removal along roads, they're basically happy with that look. It scares us to death. All I see is standing dead trees. There's way too much fuel there. I know with the fire reoccurrence history in southwestern Oregon that somewhere down the line, as that as these stands basically revert, you know, to brush fields and snag patches in short term, that is an extreme fire hazard area. It scares land managers like myself to death, knowing that I'm investing huge amounts of money to get my land back into productivity, but that risk profile is so elevated from our adjacent landowners' actions. It's a huge concern,
so,
and it should be the state's concern too, because that's a future large fire just setting up for all of us to deal with at some point in time down the line.
So catastrophic reburn. You showed us the bugs already.
Yeah.
I presume that there's potential, great potential here for disease, that sort of thing.
There's great potential for lots of variables to enter a landscape like that. And that's the challenge of the ONC is we all own these little squares, 1 mile squares,
right.
But if one landowner views that as a mini wilderness area, and the other landowner views that as a timber production area for society and economic benefit, there's this clash going on, and it's highly challenging right now.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, one thing I did fail to bring out, and I thought this brought this up. I was talking to an individual that was very knowledgeable in the timber industry, and the individual was from Canada. So I asked the individual, I said, what do you do in Canada? Well, you guys get fires, don't you? He said, yeah, sometimes we get some pretty good-sized ones. I said, what do you do with them? He said, well, we put them out. I said, well, I know, but we're trying to. And he said, no, there's a difference between Canada and the U.S. He said, in Canada, we let experts manage our forest. In the United States, it's in special interest groups.
Point well made.
I'm going to have to take the bait on that. This is a significant concern of mine. We talked about this down in Stout Creek, and I've talked with folks here before. I have been talking with other experts who are not necessarily part of the industry, but they are still experts, and they have. I'm still trying to get better information about their concerns, because it's not clear to me how they match with some of the things you've talked about. So I find that the concern that I have is that each group, each side says that the other one's a special interest group. Okay, so let's be real clear about that. There, so-and-so is a special, the forest industry is a special interest group, the environmentalists are a special interest group, depending on who you're talking to. They both are. The special interest group that I'm concerned about, quite frankly, is the state of Oregon. I am concerned that we have not really got a good consensus on how we're going to deal with our natural resources well. And some of it we can't do much about because it's federal land. And the federal special interest groups are all over the mark, in my view. For various reasons. So I want to take this, and I'll be talking with you, I'm sure, again about this, because I'd really like to have some of those experts sit down and talk about this without it being in front of a judge, and really get some sense of what we can do about this. Because the issues that I run into, and I've talked about this before, the issue I run into is a lack of trust on all sides. That the forest industry is just trying to cut down as many trees as possible and doesn't care about what happens. And the environmental groups are just there because they have no idea of what really takes place in terms of a forest. When in fact, in both sides, you can find experts that are pretty well versed academically and have been in the forest for some time. So that's my concern, and I appreciate you bringing this information forward. But it, for me, is not an easy answer at all.
So that's how I'm looking at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I want to just carry on that conversation for just a little bit to say I don't want to be a logger right now. I don't want to be a environmentalist as portrayed just recently. But I want to be the person that tries to help make whatever the landscape is healthy.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that we're controlling pests and invasive species to a point where we can actually, you know, grow something and grow it in a healthy way, and that we can be sustainable in the natural resources that we all need to be able to live on this planet. And so, I mean, I feel like I can look at those two pictures, and I have a picture that I prefer, but there may be some healthy elements on one side that I'm not noting, just because it looks sort of drab and kind of spooky looking. But I mean, it's I don't care what it looks like as much as I care that it's healthy. And healthy means it's not going to burst into flames, and healthy means that it's not going to harm the next plot of land over, and healthy means it's not going to take something that is going to cause the next piece of property and or species to have, you know, more problems. I mean, there are some places where we have to integrate, you know, what is healthy. So I just appreciate the comments that you guys made. It made me understand from your perspective on a business level or on a private property level. I'm hoping we're going to have more conversation with the state. I feel that there is no way you can have any kind of stance you want or any kind of position you want. I don't think anybody wants to have burning forests, burning property, you know, that is uncontrollable and costing us millions and causing us to have a deductible that's not sustainable. So I just, you know, I think we've got to go on to Representative Fredericks. We've got to continue to look at it holistically, and we also have to continue to try and make sure that it's a we versus an us or that or them or, you know, I mean, it's a we. We're all here on this planet together, and we all have a need for healthy. So I don't know. I just knew I was going to get frustrated when I came today on this topic because there's no easy answer, right? But the one thing I wanted to end was with, when I was a young girl, I got to go through the Tillamook burn, right? And my dad said to me that day, you will still be alive to be able to see this forest grow back. And that gave me always this feeling that, oh my gosh, that's a long time. My dad said he's not going to be here. And so that means that whatever we do with our landscape, it's a long-term process and a long-term investment. And whether it's for business or for recreation or for living on, we have to realize how valuable that landscape is, and we have to treat it well. And so we can treat it well in a lot of different ways and still have a working landscape as well as a recreational landscape and a healthy landscape. So that's my goal, those three elements.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
please.
You know, you're talking about an industry or I guess from a family forest perspective, this is a once a generation on the west side rotation, and when you're on the east side where we see more of the catastrophic fires, typically you're talking a couple generations, maybe three generations between harvests. So when you're talking about, you know, you want everybody to get along, that's great. But when a fire, and we were experiencing this year probably more than we have in the past, where you saw fires that may start on private land or may start on federal land, but they're where they used to burn into the federal land and many times stop there, they're burning through the federal land into the neighbors on the far side. So you've got impacted people from policies that these people, it's their life savings, it's their recreation, it's their retirement. I mean, and you know, and it's their way of life, and it's now being destroyed because their neighbors' policies are impacting them. So yeah, there are balances, and somehow, whether it's at the state level, the federal level, a balance has to be made. But what we're talking, the three of us talking about is the impact of private landowners from these policies from our mostly federal partners. I mean, the state ground, the Tillamook Forest, we've got fires there too, and play in state forest, but mostly we're talking federal forest versus private forest, and what happens in that interface where the two join together. And where it used to be, if a fire was going to the federal ground, it burned in the federal ground, it left the private people alone, and then, you know, we all complained about what was happening to the federal forest. Now that fire is burning through the federal ground back into the private forest, so it's impacting landowners on both sides. Mm-hmm. So somehow there's got to be something done.
I was trying to recognize that.
I think what I heard was a lot of advocacy for nobody tipping over my bucket of milk. So right. I'm encouraged. Yeah. I am going to have to move on. Before I excuse our witnesses, I just want to say thank you to the contributions that were made by the industry, by loggers, by landowners in building the fire lines, in helping us put a halt to these catastrophic fires. We hear about the efforts that firefighters make. We hear about the efforts that our National Guard make, and God bless them all. But there was a critical contribution made by the loggers in this state, and I want to thank you for that. And with that, gentlemen, I'm going to have to excuse you and move on. I call up for the impossible task of finishing up in 15 minutes, Doug Decker, Travis Medema, and Michael Hask, please.
Mr. Chair, real quick.
Yes.
If this committee would like to see a well-run forest, go to get a hold of the Coco tribe on the coast. That's near country.
In there, it's an amazing tour. Go see it.
It's unbelievably
well done. 8,000 acres, and they manage it.
Unbelievably well done.
And I've gotten a chance to actually tour a couple of other places that are really well run as well, well run forests in the Willamette Valley primarily, but also along the in the Coast Range. We've got some folks who know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some folks who know how to do this with an understanding of looking towards the future, not just one generation, but several generations. The question is, how do we, and again, for the state, since they're getting up here, they've managed to do some pretty good work. It's the federal issues that we've had to struggle with, and those federal issues come because of a lot of history in other sections, not just this last few years. It comes from a good ways back. I covered the old growth fight as a reporter, and I remember it very well. It's still disturbing to see how some things have not really come to fruition yet. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good afternoon.
With lightning speed.
Lightning speed. So we're shooting for 5:00.
Thank you so much. Yes, okay. We are.
Well, I'm going to be hard-pressed to do that. I'll do my best, Chairman Witt and members of the committee. My name's Mike Haskey. I'm with the Bureau of Land Management. 37 years with the BLM. I started as a forester in Medford, and like Phil, I was here 2 years ago. In fact, I was on the same panel as Phil. So I want to modify my opening remarks. I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the comments I just heard from that previous panel. Phil, I was on the Stouts Creek a legislative tour as well. And I asked Phil to keep raising this issue that he just raised. It's an important issue. Phil's a valuable partner, and on the ground, I think we in the BLM have a pretty good, although sometimes strained, working relationship with Roseburg Resources. Obviously, we have some wide policy gaps. The late Dean Hal Salwasser from Oregon State University talked about the ONC lands as being a wicked problem. 37 years experience here, sitting at this table. I've been working this issue 37 years, so to talk in 15 minutes.
Well, thank you for your efforts.
Okay, and I want to acknowledge Rex as well, because the loggers, we can't manage the forest the way we want to without their skills and abilities and their equipment. So I want to acknowledge both those people.
Thank you.
Or both those. Okay, so I'm the Deputy State Director for Resources, BLM. I oversee about 90 resource professionals, senior specialists for all the resource management programs we have in BLM, including fire and aviation. In Oregon, our fire
setup is different. We call it SORO, the State Office Regional Office. So it's Interagency Fire Oversight, BLM and U.S. Forest Service. And SORO provides the oversight for firefighting and our fuels program. But as you're going to see through my presentation, fuels and fire management is much more than just SORO. So real quickly, a lot of numbers. I'm not going to go through all those numbers. This slide was prepared for me by some of our SORO staff working with our Northwest Coordination Center. So that's another interagency effort, the NWCC, that works in our geographic area. I'm giving you the big picture look of the fire system. And they provide coordination on logistics, positioning of resources, and do predictive services with fire behavior and weather for us. As you can see in the region, Oregon and Washington, about 1.8 million acres impacted by fire this year. Of that, about a third of that, or 650,000 acres, here in Oregon. And of that 650,000 acres, a little over a third Forest Service, about a quarter BLM, about a quarter private, and about 16% other landowners. So you can see it's a complicated picture, and we have to work in collaboration, coordination, partnership if we're going to be successful in wildland fire. I also wanted to mention, besides the Northwest Coordination Center, we have an interagency group called the MAC, the Multi-Agency Coordination Center. It's federal agencies, BLM, BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Forest Service, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the states sit on our MAC as well. So it's the Oregon Department of Forestry, Washington Department of Natural Resources, the Oregon Fire Service, the Washington Fire Service, and the Fire Marshals for Oregon and Washington. And this group gets together, especially when it's really busy, and they do things like incident prioritization. So where do the resources go? They help with resource acquisition and allocation. So when we need heavy helicopters, they help get that for us. And they're a body that's pulled together to identify issues and look for resolution. So these numbers are statistics, a step down from the previous slide, and highlight fires that impacted BLM. I've previewed Doug's presentation. There are some fires on this list you won't see in his. For example, the Ben Dyer fire was 40 miles west of Vail. The Soda fire was in Idaho and Oregon, a big fire we had in Sagebrush Country, southwest of Boise. The Yaka Reservoir, Malheur County, down in Jordan Valley. Those didn't involve ODF. But these three fires all burned priority sagebrush habitat. And for BLM, the rangeland fires are as important as timber fires. Wildland fire and follow-up invasive weeds have been highlighted by the Fish and Wildlife Service as one of the threats to sage grouse, so we're working hard to fight and control wildland fire in the sage country. And Secretary Jewell emphasized that with a secretarial order earlier this year that said, you guys, you BLM, need to work to reduce the size, severity, and cost of rangeland fires. So rangeland fires are a priority for BLM. That's a picture from the Soda fire. Did I miss one? How do I go back?
Previous, up at the top.
On the keyboard.
Okay, so I mentioned priority sagebrush habitat on the last slide. What's that mean? We just signed land use plan amendments for the BLM for Eastern Oregon that divided the landscape in Eastern Oregon into three different categories. There's a priority habitat. There's a general habitat. This is for sage grouse. And then as a subset of that priority habitat, there's something we're calling sagebrush focal areas. So this slide shows the impact of 2015 fires on those categories of priority habitat, and these are total, not just BLM. But for context, in 2012, we had over 1 million acres of fire in sagebrush habitat in eastern Oregon. So I'd like to think that the Secretary's order and some of the efforts we've made have had an impact. I also wanted to use this slide to highlight a couple of items of particular importance. West side, we depend on our partners here, ODF, for our initial attack. East side, we depend a lot on rangeland fire protection associations, which are, I don't know what word to use, chartered, authorized under state statute, and our partners here help equip them and organize them. So they're a key part of our initial attack in the east side, and I want to thank you guys for supporting RFPAs. They're a really important partner. Like any good relationship, there's sometimes issues we need to work through. Some have popped up this year, but our goal is to keep working with ODF and those RFPAs because, like I say, they're really important. This slide I just threw in there to highlight those priority areas. The red stuff is the sagebrush focal area, the best of the best. The orangish kind of stuff is our priority habitat. And then the green is general habitat. So 10 million acres in east, southeast Oregon that we're focused on. I mentioned that our Northwest Coordination Center provides predictive services, so weather predictions, fire behavior prediction, anticipated fire behavior as one of their functions. And I just finished talking about the increased emphasis on controlling rangeland fires. So using that information, we do what we call severity funding. And we try to pre-position resources where we think the, they're going to be needed in real time. So this year, outside of our base funding for fire prevention and suppression, we allocated an additional $2.2 million on the east side and $1 million on the west side, some of which went to ODF, some went to the Coos and Douglas Fire Protection Associations. We've been very creative. I mentioned pre-positioning forces this year. We even had smoke jumpers in burns, which is very unusual. I think it was an innovative approach. Highly skilled firefighters can jump on a fire, help steer the RFPAs in, get there before the engines do. So we're trying everything we can to work on rangeland fires. Once again, working with RFPAs, critical partners. Our baseline, I mentioned ODF provides funding for, or provides our initial attack. So we have a contract was just renewed. It's a five-year contract. Our base payment to the state for that is $7.4 million. And as I showed, we did some severity funding as well. We're active in post-fire planning right now. I wanted to comment, going back to Phil's presentation, he had that slide of the 2002 fire, Timbered Rock, that was in the district I started on. We tried really hard to have an active salvage program there. We were litigated and lost in court, and that's why that project didn't get implemented. So that's part of the background reason why that area looks the way it does. And that's the same land use allocation as the Rabbit Fire that Phil showed. From 2013. So there's that policy issue that is a wicked problem, as Dean Salwasser called. So anyway, we're working on our post-fire stuff right now. We have a pretty aggressive planning process. It takes 21. We're supposed to have a finished plan, emergency stable rehabilitation plan, completed within 21 days of containment of the fire. So we're working on that. And we have partnership opportunities here, too. On the east side, we work with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on seed mixes for seeding. And we're working with the Natural Resources Conservation Service to try to address private land at the same time we're addressing public land. And I, due to time, I'm not going to go into what we might be thinking if you have questions on the Stouts and Cable Crossing. So in the interest of time, I'm going to just add a lot of pictures. I did want to highlight this one. This is the National Guard folks working on Canyon Creek. We were able to recognize with our partners a need to help support that effort, so we provided additional funds to ODF through the contract. So just some quick pictures from different fires. And last slide, closing. I think this slide represents the public sentiment towards our firefighters, and I'll do air quotes, our firefighters, because we really do, as I tried to stress here in a short period of time, we really do have a very integrated program with a lot of state and federal partners trying to do the best we can on a very challenging situation. So,
Michael, thank you so very much for your appearance and your testimony. We truly appreciate that. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Doug Decker, Oregon State Forester, Director of ODF. I'm looking at the clock. I'm sensitive to your time. We probably have about a 10 to 15 minute look. We could reschedule and do this again at your pleasure.
Committee members, do you want to?
You may have some dialogue.
Do you want to take 10 minutes, or do you need to get going, folks?
Well, we have. Don't we have something about 5:30 or 5:50?
We do. We have something in Portland as well. Sorry.
Okay. We may need to reschedule. I'd like to offer you an opportunity. I don't mean to put you on the spot. If you have a succinct comments or point that you want to make before we adjourn, I'd offer you that opportunity. Otherwise, we'll just reschedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Doug Decker, Oregon State Forester. I'm joined by Doug Graff. Doug is our new Chief of Fire, Fire Protection Division at ODF. I might maybe offer a couple things. Our job is very simple and very clear. We put the fire out. That's our job. I want to admire and acknowledge the work of the landowner community, Phil and Roger and the folks who they represent, as well as the logger and operator community. They now bear the burden of this summer's activity, whether it be tree planting or rehab, and I just want to recognize that, and I respect that. We all respect that. We would like to be able to come back to you perhaps in November. Mm-hmm. We're going to be beginning a fire program review that's going to help us look at funding, at the sustainability of our organization in the midst of a new average, which we're experiencing, as well as this policy question of what could we be doing differently to change the overall long-term cost of firefighting. And we'd like
Wonderful.
To be able to come back and talk to you in some more detail about that.
We would look forward to that, and thank you for that very generous offer.
Chair Witt,
yes.
I didn't know it was going to end this way, so if I could add just two quick points.
Please.
One, we're working on a revised plan for the ONC, and fire resiliency is a key issue. And I, too, would offer anytime. I'm happy to come up to this body and represent the BLM and be involved with discussions. I'm happy to do that anytime, any place.
Michael, that's very gracious. Thank you so much. Vice Chair McLean.
The only thing that I thought that I was getting, and I'm hoping that since we have a chance to come back with you guys, that I don't think anybody has any qualms at all that, like you said, your job is to put out the fire. Mm-hmm. And you guys together as this team do a miraculous job.
Thank you.
But I think the question that I think was somewhere in all that dialogue was, what can we do so you have a smaller job?
What,
you know, I want your job to be easier, I want it to be smaller, and I want us to figure out this reporting issue that you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. If you've noticed something, if there's something that you folks as experts at putting out fires can say, you know, if we did this, we wouldn't have that fire put out.
We can definitely bring you some specific ideas that have to do with firefighting strategy, but more importantly have to do with land management
yes,
policy.
Yes, that's what I want.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, actually what we'd like to do is put them out of the firefighting business.
Yes,
there
that's
you go. that would be great, wouldn't it? Representative Frederick.
Thank you. We can't do much about the lightning stuff, though, but the other
we'll
stuff is really
yeah.
good. I just want to thank you. I have been able to go through a number of the fires, and they have been extraordinarily informative, and I don't enjoy going down there to them. I don't like to see them, but I've now been to 8, I think, fires at this point, and it's at least fires in this role. Mm-hmm. I did fires as a reporter. Mm-hmm. You folks have been outstanding, every one of you, and all of the private groups as well. Just really an extraordinary experience. Thank you
very much. We'll pass that on.
And with that, thank you, committee members. More excellent discussion as usual. We stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Discussion as usual. We stand adjourned.